Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Wellwithal. Wellwithal believes that self-care is community care. Premium products crafted for your daily wellness, from sleep support to heart health to your daily regimen. 20% of Wellwithal's profits are committed to leading the fight for health equity. They won't stop until it is truly Wellwithal.
And The Huntington, presenting Toni Stone, the remarkable true story of the first woman to shatter expectations and play pro baseball on a men's team, May 17th through June 16th at the Huntington Theater, huntingtontheater.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, undeterred by the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, President Trump is ready to have another budget fight with Congress. As part of his 2020 budget, he's asking for $8.5 billion for his wall, with Trump making this his campaign priority and the Democrats making it theirs to defeat him on this. What's another budget battle going to mean for us? We take on this, Paul Manafort's sentencing, and more on today's Politics Roundup.
1 week after a high-stakes nuclear summit between Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump, satellite images show North Korea restoring facilities at a long-range rocket site. We'll ask Charlie Sennett what this means for diplomatic work the Trump administration has put into with North Korea. At noon, we'll open the lines and ask you, how old is too old to run for president? Is there a point when the elder statesman is just too darn elderly? That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Friday, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Good morning, Jim.
Before we start, how about that Metropolitan Corral thing we narrated yesterday?
It was Old Saints Parrot.
Was that unbelievable?
Yeah, if people haven't heard of them, the Metropolitan Corral, they were wonderful, and their conductor was pretty good.
Metropolitan Corral is unbelievable. It was a concert about protest music during the Holocaust, South Africa during apartheid. It was fabulous. Check them out, Metropolitan Corral.
That's right. A little culture for us, Jim.
It was. So if the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again but expecting different results, what are we to make of the fact that President Trump is asking Congress for $8.5 billion to fund his wall in the 2020 budget? Is this to fire up his base? Is it to impress Ann Coulter, who he called a wacky nut job over the weekend? And is it worth it if it means setting up another budget fight that could lead to another government shutdown? Here with us in Studio 3 to take on this, the latest on the 2020 race, and other political headlines from the White House to the State House for Steve Kerrigan and Jennifer Becerris. Jennifer's a political columnist, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum. Steve is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund and former CEO of the Democratic National Convention. Steve, Jennifer, good to see you.
Thanks for having us.
So let's start with the sentencing of Paul Manafort last week. It's caused sort of an uproar, especially, I think, after so many TV commentators were talking about he's going to die in prison and he could be a life sentence and all that, and he ends up getting 47 months.
Seven or eight of which have already been served.
Yeah, Nancy Gertner, who is a former federal judge herself, pointed out this is the kind of sentence usually goes to a cooperating witness, and he and Manafort was charged with, allegedly feigned cooperation and kept lying. And there was this great quote in the New York Times from this public defender who was talking about people's sense of the justice system being unfair, particularly to rich white defendants. And he said, for context on Manafort's 47 months in prison, my client yesterday was offered 36 to 72 months for stealing $100 worth of quarters from a residential laundry room. So you're an attorney. What'd you think of this?
I did think it was on the lighter end, but I'm also with Judge Gertner in believing that a lot of sentences are too harsh and too draconian. I don't personally believe in harsh mandatory minimums. I think judges should have discretion. And I do think that white-collar crimes, where they're, by definition not violent, should be punished less harshly than violent crimes. So I'm not disturbed. I'm not disturbed that the sentence was light, given those beliefs. I do think even so, it was a little on the light side. But he's going to be in prison for a long time. He's being sentenced again for other crimes by another district court judge,
right.
And he's going to pay for what he did.
But you know, the other part of this that I am amazed, by the way, Judge Gertner will be with me tonight on Greater Boston. She wrote a piece in the Washington Post. We'll talk about that and have a little debate. He never apologized either.
Right.
You know, it seems to me there's some basic things you're supposed to do.
Right.
You're supposed to cooperate, not lie. You're supposed to apologize, not say just that your life was ruined. We know your life was ruined. Whether mm-hmm. I'm sort of a lighter sentence person, too, like you and Gertner. But I was mystified. I didn't think he'd get 19 or whatever, 24 years,
right.
the guidelines suggested.
Well, hold on
but
for a second.
4 years.
Hold on
well,
for a second.
What?
It's fine to talk about lighter sentences, but everybody should be getting lighter sentences.
Well, that's correct.
I mean, that
yeah.
is the big problem here. And one of the biggest mistakes Barack Obama made, as far as I'm concerned, is not sending anybody to jail from Wall Street for what happened when people lost their homes.
You
and
have to
lost
prosecute
their savings.
Him to send him to Wall
well,
Street.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But
that's
you,
a whole other thing.
Not to Wall Street, to jail. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I'm sorry, Steve.
Did I say send him to Wall Street?
I said
I'm sorry.
It. Not I said it. Not you. Go
you
ahead,
should send somebody to jail, and then you see all these black and brown defendants
oh, yeah?
that are, you know, on marijuana charges
well,
and doing years.
Well, Kwame Kirkpatrick, the former mayor of
Detroit yeah.
was in jail for 24 years for doing a lot of the similar crimes that Paul Manafort just got sentenced for. And remember, I mean, my big concern, and again, I'm not a lawyer, so I tend to agree with Jennifer in terms of the lighter sentence thing, but you know, the otherwise blameless life that the judge indicated. I mean, this is a man who's being sentenced, as you said, this Wednesday for another crime that he committed while on house arrest for a third crime. So this guy really hasn't lived an otherwise blameless life.
Mm-hmm.
The only consolation that I have in all of this is that Donald Trump has taught us one thing about life, which is that 4 years can seem like a life sentence.
And so, thank you very much.
So,
we're here in the lounge on Thursdays,
good
and you should
Steve.
Try the veal. You know, your father was a federal judge,
he
right?
A federal
so
judge.
He is
yeah.
a federal. So you have federal judging in your
He's
family.
He's actually written a book about the sentencing.
He has?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
This is your time to plug it. Go ahead.
It is.
On Amazon.
It's called Fear of Judging. And he wrote it with my stepmother, Kate
oh,
Stith, who teaches a course with Nancy Gertner on sentencing.
This is the most incestuous
so.
Thing I've
so
ever heard
did,
in my
so
life.
So did you ask Dad over the weekend? What
no,
you
I did not.
This?
Okay, good.
Actually, I've spoken with him.
But and also, you know, one of the things that there was some member of Congress, I'm sorry, I forgot his name, was on the Oversight Committee, said on CNN the other night, well, and he didn't put it this literally, don't worry, the second judge on Wednesday will make up for this.
Right.
And, you know, while and there was a former Republican attorney general almost had his head pop off correctly saying you're not supposed to make up sentences. But,
right.
you know, remember Gagan? Gagan,
the priest?
Yeah.
The priest.
Yes, I do.
He pats a kid on his behind in a pool and he gets 10 years. And everybody knew, even though the judge never admitted, he didn't get 10 years
for that.
For patting the kid on the behind in the pool. He got 10 years for the crimes for which he was never prosecuted. As a matter of reality, not as a matter of what is right and wrong, isn't the pressure going to be on this judge on Wednesday to do a makeup job for what Ellis didn't do there?
Well, this is the beauty of life tenure, is that judges are not politically pressured or shouldn't be to do anything one way or the other. They're insulated, and as they should be, so that they can look at the facts and the law before them and make individualized determinations.
We're talking to Jennifer Buss Harrison, Steve Kerrigan.
Okay, let's talk a little bit of presidential politics here. There's big schisms in the Democratic Party now, concern that the party is moving too far to the left. Bernie Sanders was the guy that was so far on the left before. We have Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I think, probably horrifying lots of people by calling Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal policies racist and Ronald Reagan racist. I heard Hickenlooper, the governor or the senator out there.
He was Colorado. Governor.
Governor, Colorado.
Governor, Colorado.
Who apparently couldn't answer a question about whether or not he's a capitalist. So,
and he was a businessman before he was governor.
So there does seem to be this breakup in the Democrats.
Why don't you ask the Democrat, not the...
No, go ahead, ask Jen.
No, but to follow up on Martin's question.
There's another crack up in my
Steve
party,
Kerrigan,
so.
There was a great story, I think, in Politico saying all the Democratic senators who in 2016 thought that Bernie Sanders was an extremist
right.
are now saying if he gets the votes, we're fine with him. There are Sanders bragged the other day, I think correctly, that not virtually everybody, but a lot of the Democratic field have adopted his policies,
yep.
maybe his and Warren's, I think he could argue. Do you worry about waking up the day after the election in 2020? I'm serious about this and saying, how could we not have seen that the move towards Ocasio-Cortez's worldview and Sanders' worldview, et cetera, was a pathway to reelection of Donald Trump. Do you not worry about that?
I worry about Donald Trump's reelection every day.
No, but for this reason.
Yeah, no, and I want, we've got a long way to go in this campaign, and there's a lot to be done and to be said. And I will give Senator Sanders a lot of credit. And I think we've talked about this on the show before, is that I don't think his ideas have pulled the party further left. I think the country has moved to understand that some version of Medicare for All, be it what Pete Buttigieg talked about, which is Medicare for those who would like it, or others have talked about Medicare at 50, where you can buy in as a public option. I mean, those ideas are becoming more and more mainstream because healthcare costs aren't going down, because people need to increase access. The college affordability is hitting every family across the country. So all of those things that seemed like crazy left-wing ideas in 2016, some version of them are becoming much more acceptable for 2020. What I appreciate...
But by the way, that's all without a campaign against them from Donald Trump and the Republicans.
Right.
And we're having a conversation in isolation,
yes,
about the move, with which I'm in agreement with you. But that's, again, without them being damned by the opposition.
True. But I mean, what I do appreciate about Senator Sanders this time around that we didn't see last time is that he seems to be acutely aware of any blame that some people send his way for Hillary Clinton losing in November. I don't think he does one public appearance without saying, I hope to be the Democratic nominee, but if I am not, I'm going to work incredibly hard for the Democratic nominee.
I think
he literally says it
every
time I've seen him speak. He says that, whether it's in an interview or a speech. And I think that's an important message to send to his supporters as early as possible, those who were with him in 16 or those who might have joined the team this time that weren't there last time, that we've got to be behind whoever the Democratic nominee is to make sure that we don't get four more years of Donald Trump.
I think the question you ask, Jim, is exactly the right one. And
thank you.
I think the Democrats have to be careful about this. And you said this last time we were here, that haven't they just handed Donald Trump his tagline for 2020? I mean, you hear it at the rallies already. We will never be a socialist country. That's it. It's not make America great again this time. It's we will never be a socialist country, and he will win.
Wow. I don't know. Because I think the idea about social, because first of all, it isn't socialism.
Right.
And second of all, I think the idea of the appeal of capitalism, when you look at people that are under 40 that can't afford to buy, you know, a six pack of beer between their college loan debt and their housing costs, there's a strong view there that the unregulated capitalism is not working.
Millennials are incredibly entitled. You know, they want everything paid for, their birth control, their lattes, their this, their that. They want.
I don't think anyone wants their lattes.
Cradle to grave entitlements, right? That like Obama's campaign in his last reelection, the life of Julia. They want the government to take care of them from the time they're born to the time they die. But that viewpoint ultimately will not prevail.
Well, so I think as this campaign goes on and people talk more about the economic conditions that we're facing, people of all stripes, not just millennials and not just progressives or liberals, they're understanding the squeeze of higher education costs. They know what the impact of no early childhood education is hitting them. We're seeing it now here in Massachusetts with the yet another talk of increasing T rates. I mean, there are all kinds of factors that keep going up to impact working everyday families in America, and they're eventually going to look at the candidate, and this is incumbent on us as Democrats, they're going to look at the candidate who speaks to them and to that dignity of work that Sherrod Brown talked about during his also brief campaign for the presidency. It was, because his voice was great for this, but hopefully he'll keep fighting. But that dignity of work piece and explaining what party, the party who wins is the party who actually comes up with solutions for people and the problems that they face every day at their kitchen table.
Right.
We're going to have rhetoric on our side.
Free market
don't
scare
people.
Solutions
that don't scare people.
But because you know, be more appealing.
You know, Marjorie.
Oh, do you think so?
I
think the jig is so up on that.
You do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Marjorie declaring for socialism.
Well, here's why. I think you have these uncovering of people that are doing all the right things and they're broke. And when we had that federal government shutdown, and you learn that depending on whom you read, 50%, 60%, sometimes 70% of Americans with full-time jobs are working paycheck to paycheck. It seems to me if you're still buying trickle-down economics.
I don't know.
My son was
sitting in the green room looking at a YouTube video about Cuba, and he's watching this thing, and he says, Mom, Do you know that in Cuba, the shopkeepers earn the same amount of money regardless of how much they sell? That is absurd.
You've trained them well.
Yeah, you know, but can I get really can people I, buy that?
Wait. Yes.
But it's true.
Turning
can
into
I get this point out? You and I fight about this. This is a really important point.
What's
for
really
this
important
election.
Point, Jim?
70% of the people, or some insanely high number, mm-hmm. support the 70% marginal tax rate. You know what that number is exactly like, Marjorie? It's exactly like the number of people who supported my ballot question in the 90s. Wait, let
you
me finish.
Keep going back.
No, let me finish.
All these years
on
ago.
On the graduate income tax, excuse me. And you know what happened? Mm-hmm. I ended up with 29% of the vote because the opposition lied about who was going to be affected.
It was such a totally different time. That was the time that Bill Clinton was cracking down on welfare.
Okay,
that was
so let me try this.
Government was
let me try
to
this. I'm Donald Trump. I'm Donald Trump in a debate. Okay, Bernie Sanders or Amy Klobuchar, well, it won't be Amy Klobuchar, supporting 70%. So-and-so supports the top marginal tax rate.
Right.
I have seen their documents which say they're going to start with people making more than $1 million a year, and then in the third year, it's going to come down to people making $50,000 a year.
We just had the convicted liar felon going to prison more believable to Americans in the United States than the president of the United States.
Michael Cohen?
You believe those polls.
Except he lied in the hearing also, we found out.
Yeah, I know, but that's very devastating.
That's a good point.
And I just don't buy that people are so stupid, frankly, that after—
You think capitalism is stupid?
Unregulated, unregulated capitalism. I mean, we look at all these economists from Piketty to, I'm sure you think Krugman doesn't know what he's talking about.
No, he doesn't.
But I mean, look at where I grew up at a time, and I'm a lot older than you.
No, you're not.
When you could support, because of unionization, because of wages growing up, when dad could support the whole family, and you could take a nice little vacation on Cape Cod, and you could send your kid to college. That's done. And I think people
there
realize—
There are strong arguments to be made that that is because of the growing presence of government in our lives, and because government is
no,
taking
that is because of the Reagan tax cuts of the 80s.
Well,
that changed, that shifted
I mean,
everything.
Look, you could bring in two economists
that
and you could argue
everything.
Both sides.
Yeah.
But the timeline of that is nothing to be argued with. In the 60s, when President Kennedy had much higher tax rates, he started the tax rate deduction. And then President Reagan's massive overhaul of the tax system set up what has become this 91%, 1%.
Well, you know, get Stephen Moore in here, some economist from the Heritage Foundation, and he'll tell you exactly the opposite.
Well, I mean,
but let me tell you, I appreciate all your opinions.
Yeah.
I want to hear what the woman who ran the massage parlor in Florida, who supports Trump, thinks about this. So can we move to this budget battle thing? I have to say, Steve, you know, Democrats, their heads are ready to explode over this thing. You know, he wants a 5% cut in all domestic programs, wants $8.5 billion, as if any presidential budget has meant anything
in
our lifetime.
Yeah.
And so I assume that the Democrats are playing it up, maybe wisely, to say the guy doesn't get it on the wall, not because it's gone anywhere. Is that?
It's going absolutely nowhere. And even Republicans don't want to relitigate this whole thing. They were hoping that, I think part of them are hoping that this national emergency thing will continue to play out in the courts or whatever, but that it'll dissipate over time. We'll stop talking about paying for that wall. And they were hoping that the president would stop talking about paying for the wall, but he has doubled down. I don't know why he has, but a presidential budget proposal, as you suggested, is a press release. Like it's going to go absolutely nowhere not just the Democratic House, but in the Republican-controlled Senate, because they don't want that debate.
You know, speaking of the Republican-controlled Senate and in stoking the base, we know that there are theoretically enough Republican votes for, with Rand Paul's being the fourth, to vote to reject the president's emergency declaration, will then be vetoed, and there apparently aren't enough votes to override it. But almost every day, Jennifer Braceras, I read a story about yet another Republican who is not voting against the president, who is deeply unhappy about the precedent this declaration is setting.
Right.
And people like Lamar Alexander said, go find the money. So there are a lot of places to find the money, says he, short of an emergency declaration. What's the outcome to this thing, both in on the merits and politically for Donald Trump, if they do reject his emergency declaration and then his veto is sustained?
Well, I think politically everybody wins because his veto will be sustained and members of the Republican caucus can say, I stood on principle. And so they both get to go back to their constituencies and say, you know, they did what they promised they would do. So politically, I think that it's exactly what the Republicans are hoping
for. You don't think that there's potential for the four to grow into 14 when the push comes to shove on the ultimate vote, that there is a tsunami of Senate
Republicans?
It's possible,
and I would like to see that personally, but if it
because
does,
you're not happy with the precedent of it either.
No, I don't like the precedent at all. I mean, I'm for stronger border security, and I don't. I'm fine with the president building a wall, but I do not like his way of going about it.
We're talking to Jennifer Beceris and Steve Kerrigan.
I think we have to leave so we have some time for some local stuff.
No, one more thing. We're going to talk to our listeners.
One more thing we're talking about.
Did you read the piece in the Globe this weekend, Linda Rodriguez McRobbie in the ideas section?
Too
old
age.
To be president.
Yeah.
Science says yes. We've talked about it here, whether these candidates, you know, Sanders is currently 77, Biden, should he run 76. Even Elizabeth Warren, 69, Jay Inslee from Washington, 68, et cetera. We haven't talked about it from a scientific perspective. We've talked about, you know, what kind of statement does it make when you're trying to lure young voters mm-hmm. and the leadership of the Democratic Party in the House is old, the candidates are old, and that sort of thing. She makes a pretty compelling case on the science from cognitive function, memory, all this sort of stuff. Starting with you, Steve, how much do you think age – I mean, by the two front runners, by the way, in the Iowa poll I saw last night, by a landslide, it's mid-20s for Biden, low 20s for Sanders.
Yeah.
Everybody else is in single digits. Do you worry about that?
I worry about it if someone puts an awful lot of money behind an ad campaign to push the science of being too old of a candidate. I think the ideas and
the experience. Of course, Donald Trump is not a kid either. He's
right,
the
exactly,
oldest president
exactly.
ever elected.
So,
yeah.
I mean, if they were running a 45-year-old.
This isn't a partisan issue.
If they were running a 45-year-old candidate, you can guarantee, though, they would be talking more about it. And we would probably be doing the same thing in the general election. But we've got a lot of candidates who are in their 60s and 70s, as you said. This, I think, is going to come down, hopefully, to experience and values and principles. And, I mean, it is a compelling article. But we've also, I worked for Ted Kennedy when he was in his mid-70s and he had all of his cognitive abilities and was passed the most pieces of bipartisan legislation.
But he wasn't president of the United States.
No,
and
he
by
wasn't.
The way,
no.
While Trump was 70 when he was elected, the oldest president ever when elected, Bernie Sanders would be, I think, 79.
He would be.
There
is
a huge difference. It's not like 40 to 49. Yeah. 70 to 79 is a big differential. Do you think it becomes an issue, or is Trump's age mute the
No,
whole
I think
thing?
It's absolutely an issue. And I personally believe in age limits, both for the presidency and for Supreme Court justices, because I think it's not dangerous in the sense that our institutions are strong and none of these people, you know, even a president of the United States doesn't operate on his own whim. There are cabinet secretaries, there's Congress, there are courts, there are White House staff. But you don't want a situation where the staff is essentially running the show and propping up, you know, whether it's Donald Trump or Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The law clerks were not appointed. They did not go through Senate confirmation. The chief of staff was not elected by the people. And personally, I think that Supreme Court justices should have to retire at 80. And I think probably the same age for the president. And so if you're going to be 80 years old during your term, I don't think you should be eligible to run. Of course, this would all take constitutional amendment. But
yeah, I just think that, I mean, 70 is a lot younger these days than it was when I was a kid. There are a lot of people working well
Thank
into
God.
Their... I know, right?
Exactly.
Working well into...
80 is going to be a lot younger soon.
It doesn't mean you can't contribute, right? I mean, somebody that age could still...
obviously.
I mean, look,
right.
Yeah,
you could be a hell of a grandmother or grandfather,
no,
right?
You could still be a cabinet secretary. You could, for example, as a Supreme Court justice, you could go back and ride circuit and sit on panels with lower court judges. But there are certain jobs that are too important, I
it's
think.
True. And the brain games, I guess they don't help the way we all thought they were, right?
So what are we going to say there, Steve, before we break?
No, I just think that this is going to be an issue that people discuss. I think it's an early one. In the end, if we nominate someone in the 70s, they nominate someone in the 70s, it's going to be about the issues and the values and what we can do for the country.
And we're going to take your calls on that issue at noon, by the way, so stick around.
But we need a little time because we're going to talk about a couple of local things when we get back. We're talking with Jennifer Beceris and Steve Kerrigan. You listen to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Bredow. She's Marjorie Egan. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking politics. Well, whether you're just tuning in or not, we're still talking politics with Steve Kerrigan, former CEO of the Democratic National Convention, and political columnist Jennifer Beceris.
So talk about the government spending money, Jennifer Beceris. there seems to be a movement toward spending big money on fixing the MBTA. What do you think? You think that can go anywhere here? We're talking about gas taxes, putting more fees on Uber and Lyft, congestion, toll pricing, et cetera, in addition to lifting fares on the T.
Well, I personally favor user fees and having them be directed towards exactly what it is you're using. So tolls paying for roads, higher T fares paying for the T. I don't favor a global approach. As a conservative, I like to see money targeted specifically towards what it's going to pay for. So.
But pressure seems to be, I mean, there's this piece, I think it was in Commonwealth magazine,
yeah,
talking about how members of the, is it called the Fiscal Control Board?
Yeah.
By the way, the governor is going to be with us on March 21st. We just got a date a couple of days ago. I forgot to mention at noon.
Fiscal and Management Control Board. Jim.
Right. They have generally been in the Baker column in terms of let's stay within the fee thing. And all of a sudden, Brian Lang, a union president, and a couple of other members of the five-member board are starting to talk about those options that are exactly the ones that Marjorie mentioned. I assume emboldened by the fact that even though Governor Baker obviously was elected as a no new tax governor, he has obviously shown, I think to his credit, frankly, in his second term, much more, let's call it flexibility, even though he would say he's still not violating his pledge. So, which I assume gives these transportation people an opening. Are we all only going to see a broader spectrum of financing for T-fixing?
I mean, I think we have to. And I think that the financial or fiscal management and control board is realizing what so many people who ride the T all the time have known for years, which is billions and billions and billions of dollars are needed to update the T. And just to catch up, we need billions of dollars. And then to make improvements or to make it a world-class mass transit system, which it should be for a world-class city like Boston, we really need that. The reason why I'm thrilled that they're looking at the broad approach is gas tax increases, all these other things that help encourage people to then use mass transit or the T, get off the roads, help us with climate change. Also, by the way, we can then get more riders so that their fares go into the general fund and help fund repairs. I mean, there's got to be a global approach because there's a massive global problem. This cannot be done fee for service because there's a lot of folks who realize, you know what, if the T keeps going up, I'm going to either ride my bike or I'm going to go carpool or I'm going to drive because the train, the commuter rail in particular, is not convenient enough for me. And then you're adding more cars to the roadway. And so I'm thrilled to see them approach it. I hope the governor does. I do think his no tax pledge in the first term did exactly what it was intended to do, which was to give him a second term. And hopefully he continues down the path that I think is right, which is to look at all options for doing what he promised to do, which was fix the T, fix our education system, and things that frankly require investment from the taxpayer.
It has to absolutely, though, be earmarked for specific transportation projects and not just, we're raising the taxes on transportation and raising the gas tax and it's going into a general fund. And, we say we're going to fix the T, but who knows, maybe it'll go towards education or something else.
I can't imagine Baker ever agreeing to anything that was not earmarked.
Yeah.
I mean, the problem with that is Marjorie throws in my face constantly is there was a cigarette tax increase on the ballot, which was earmarked in the early 90s, either 92 or 94, which did go to prevention and whatever it was mandated to do for a few years, but it was purely a statute. And as a result, after a handful of years, they diverted the money to the general fund. But I want to get back to your user fee thing. I would argue in a perverse way that a gas tax ends up being a user fee. And I'll tell you why, vis-a-vis the T. This is in part of what Steve was saying a minute ago. If the gas tax is raised, one, arguably, assuming it's earmarked, the T gets better and more attractive, fewer people on the roads, more people do that, fewer people drive, which means if you continue to drive and pay the gas tax, you're going to have an easier way, so you're the user of the road. And it seems to be a couple of things. I've mentioned this in the air. DeWine, the governor of Ohio, who used to lobby when he was a congressman, and I was doing legal services stuff, very conservative, raised the gas tax. The Democratic governor of Michigan last week proposed a 45-cent increase in the gas tax. And Congressman Steve Lynch has said to us on a number of occasions, the best time to raise the gas tax is when the price of gas is as low as it is. So the impact on people. So it seems to me that may be the thing of choice here, even though Baker's in a tough position because he supported the ballot question that repealed the indexing on the last modest gas tax increase.
I mean, it's still a regressive tax. Working class people drive to work. And, you know...
Well, they might take
but if you make the team more affordable and better then,
well,
and more
why,
reliable.
Why are you limiting their choices? Why are you making life more complicated and difficult for them? I mean, do you
because
assume
the
they
tea,
all live near a T station?
No, but the answer is we're not helping them. When the T doesn't do its job, when the roads are like in gridlock,
no, but
we're not
a working
class
person in Malden or Woburn can't necessarily jump on
public transportation. Yeah, but if you live out where I live in Lancaster and you miss...
Where is Lancaster?
It's God's country. It's Northwest County. Straight out Route 2. But if you miss the...
Johnny Appleseed.
Johnny Appleseed, exactly. If you miss the, I think, 8:49 commuter rail train, which is a late one to come into town,
right.
The next one's at 10:20.
Right, good luck.
And the one before that is like 7:30, and the one before that is 6:55. So there's really not a lot of option. And if you're running late or there's a bus in front of you or something...
change the schedule?
Well, I've talked to the MBTA about that, and they say it's just too hard. Which is just, I mean, they should be buying a switching lot out in Gardner and by Wachusett where they can leave other cars. They should be running shorter trains, all those things. But because of, they currently, if you get on that commuter rail, there are probably 3 cars occupied and 12 cars empty because they say they don't have any place to put the cars. So they're hauling empty cars back and forth between Mount Wachusett Community College out in Gardner and Boston because they didn't buy a lot out there. I mean, there's so many fixes that could be done. And you imagine the fuel reductions if you're not hauling.
Is this called striking a nerve, I believe? Oh, is that what this is called? Go ahead there, Steve.
Sorry.
He's gone. He's, as they say, done a deep dive.
I am done a deep dive.
Can
you imagine the fuel costs of hauling 12 empty T cars? And these are the massive commuter rail, double level cars that they haul just because they don't own land. I mean, I think the need to fix stuff with the T should have everything on the
table.
Sorry about that.
I did. I just made a note. We'll tell the governor on the 21st.
Yeah, please tell
Steve
him. I'll call in.
Steve all over this situation.
Right.
Good to
Justice
see you.
Justice for Lancaster.
Thank you very much.
Exactly. Nice to meet your kid, too, by the way, Jennifer.
Yeah, thank
you. Great.
Jennifer Becerra is a political columnist, senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, and a former commissioner for the United States Commission on Civil Rights. Steve Kerrigan is president and co-founder of the Massachusetts Military Heroes Fund and former CEO of the National Democratic Convention. Thank you both very much for coming in. And coming up, what is North Korea up to? Satellite images indicate they're planning a space launch. Charlie Sennett joins for that and other global headlines next. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. After the first U.S.-North Korea summit, President Trump declared there is no longer a nuclear threat from North Korea. In June, he said that Kim Jong-un assured him that he was already destroying a key rocket launch facility. Today, as you probably know, satellite images show the facility has not only been rehabilitated, but preparations are underway that seem consistent with an actual rocket launch. So what does this mean for U.S.-North Korea relations? Now, will Trump go back to calling Kim Little Rocket Man, or will the two leaders be able to restore whatever diplomatic inroads they may have made in Singapore? Joining us for his take on this and other global headlines is Charlie Sennett. Charlie is a news analyst here at GBH, where he also heads up the Ground Truth Project. Hey there, Charlie.
Hey, Jim.
Hi, Charlie. So what does this mean, what Jim was talking about, that North Korea is showing signs and satellite images are indicating that he's up to no good over there?
Yeah. Hate to say I told you so, but I told you so.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised. I'm really not. I'm not surprised that the talks are now in danger of really, really unraveling. I'm not surprised that Kim Jong-un would, you know, sort of show his true colors and go about his very intentional and methodical march toward developing nuclear weapons and developing the technology they'll need for them to be able to have ICBMs. This is serious business, and you can't say you fall in love with a murderous dictator. You can't say that you have, you know, like a special relationship and sort of do PR spin on something as complex, as volatile, and really potentially dangerous to disrupting the whole region of the Korean Peninsula as talks with North Korea on denuclearization. I just think we have to all continue as journalists to keep pushing hard on how President Trump was not prepared for these talks. And when you're not prepared in a diplomatic setting this complex, things can go south really fast, and that looks like exactly what's happening.
Well, what I don't understand about the second visit is that the president's closest advisors were not keen on this, and you know, it diffused. The first visit diffused, I think, a lot of people's fears that we were about to get into some kind of nuclear confrontation with North Korea, and that was great. And even though it wasn't terrific, they were talking. So was it just the idea that the president wanted to keep the talks going or try to be cordial or what?
You know, I don't know, Marjorie. I think it's hard to read into President Trump a lot of intention. I think all of us want to be positive as possible with any movement towards anything that could be considerably in the direction of peace talks as opposed to warmongering. So I think all of us were supportive of the hope that we might actually see some progress in these talks. But I think it's also really important to dial it back and take some context and say, okay, how did this get started? This really got started when President Trump began to really saber-rattle with North Korea, calling him Rocket Man, Jim, as you said in your introduction. Little Rocket Man, in fact, and our button is bigger than your button. And, you know, really, really pushing every button he could with this son of a dictator, now the new authoritarian head of this really, you'd have to say, thuggish, murderous regime of North Korea. You know, when you cause a crisis and then you step back from that crisis to develop a relationship with the person you caused the crisis with, you can't claim that as a diplomatic victory. And you can't claim it as a victory for sure when those talks you try to get underway to calm down the situation you created fall apart. We got to be tough on foreign policy with President Trump. It's too dangerous a world out there. I think the policy with North Korea has been reckless by many accounts. You know, there are really smart analysts looking at this who feel he's done nothing different than presidents before him except stir a nest of hornets in the Korean Peninsula, which is not a good idea.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett. You know, Charlie, we talk to you every week, and you, to your credit, never miss an opportunity to celebrate the value and work of international journalists and also the dangers that they encounter. I thought of you on Friday. I'm reading the Washington Post, and there was a story by Siobhan O'Grady saying on International Women's Day, these female journalists and activists are behind bars. And she talks about at least 32 female journalists in places like China, Iran, Egypt, Saudi Arabia are in behind bars around the world. Fill in a few blanks for us in some of these cases, if you can, Charlie.
Sure. I mean, thanks, first of all, for bringing it up. You know, we have to keep forefront in our mind the peril that journalists face out there in the world. And really, truly, women face unique peril among our colleagues as journalists, that targeting women is something that's happening around the world, and particularly cyber attacks on women journalists are just extraordinary. It's something like one in three women have had direct cyber, you know, hostility directed at them as journalists. And it's really, there's data that's showing that it's encouraging young journalists, emerging journalists, the ones we work with, from not wanting to go into the business because it's just too exhausting to put up with the constant harassment. That said, on a much bigger global scale, there are people locked up who are literally behind bars or have been put under house arrest or harassed, and in some cases even tortured, as Committee to Protect Journalists is sharing with us. And two in particular, I would say China has a lot to answer for here. There are at least seven female journalists who are behind bars in China. Six are held on anti-state charges, which are just trumped-up charges. And we really have to keep an eye on them. We have to be sure, even as we work with China on trade deals, what are we putting on the table in terms of human rights and freedom of the press? The other one is Egypt, you know, a country where Ground Truth has done a lot of work, and we've worked with so many journalists, particularly female journalists there, who find it almost impossible to work in a real way to get real Ground Truth in Egypt. And one of them is Amal Fati, who's a broadcaster. And she was sharing on social media that she's being harassed all the time. And she pointed out one harassment that happened at a bank, and she tweeted out that the government does not do enough to protect women in Egypt. I think that's a very fair analysis to make as a journalist or as a human being. And she was arrested for that, and that was called fake news. She was charged with spreading fake news for saying the government doesn't do enough to protect women. That's wild. And then they tried to label this other trumped-up charge on her about being part of the April 6th movement, which is a labor movement and a pro-democracy movement, and they're calling it a terrorist organization. It's a time in Egypt where the kind of populist authoritarianism is rising in ways that's reaching a much higher volume, and I try my best to keep an ear to it, but I think on this day when we're definitely thinking about the role that women play in leadership around the world, really good day to look at female journalists and some of the hassles they're facing.
We're talking to Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project. Charlie, the president just last week weakened this rule that told the government they had to annually make public civilians killed in airstrikes outside the conventional war zones. Apparently, this was an Obama-era rule, and the idea was to constrain, according to the New York Times, the use of drone strikes and commando raids targeting Islamic militants in places like Pakistan. And they wanted to know how many the so-called collateral damage of that. So what do we make of this?
Well, it's really concerning. I think this idea that we should be accounting for civilians who are killed in our military operations is really important. To revoke the executive order just kind of clears the path for reckless behavior. I think it's the wrong message to send to the military. You know, I would hasten to add, though, that President Obama, if you remember, we often criticized him for a great increase in drone strikes. He really used them aggressively. And in an unparalleled way, and many analysts brought those that reality forward and had data to back that up. So I think President Obama both did two things. He increased the use of drone strikes. They've decreased under President Trump. But President Obama also created a system of accountability, and I'm really concerned about stripping that away. I have not heard, at least, any military analysts and a high level who I've spoken to saying there's a concern that they feel restrained by this research that's required. And it's a really good idea for us to constantly check ourselves. I think it's distressing to see that it's being stripped away.
But I guess what I don't understand is, I mean, I know that the president is often turns things over because Barack Obama did them and Barack Obama did this. Or is this more nefarious that it has to do with just not wanting to get accurate reports while these wars are continuing? Although he's obviously, to his credit, the president's talked about pulling our troops back. So we don't know how many people are dying. I mean, what's the motivation, I guess, is my question.
You know, I wish I knew, Marjorie. I feel I don't know. I do not know how to read the motivation of President Trump or his administration on so many of these things. But I do know this. It's out of step with the Department of Defense and Congress and how they're really thinking about this. And there's been a lot of very responsible voices within the American military who have understood that if we're going to exert our power around the world, we're going to have to do it in ways where we are incredibly careful of civilian casualties. And any kind of reckless policy that seeks to not be accountable around that, it's not just sort of dark and sinister. It's just bad policy. It's not going to help us be effective in the regions where we want to exert power in a productive way. And I'm hoping there will be real pressure and real pushback from Congress on this.
Well, you know, Marjorie asked you the key question for me, too. You know, what's behind this other than if Obama did it, I don't like it. I assume, not having your base of knowledge, that common sense suggests it's one of two things. It's if you're a leader in this situation, secrecy is better than transparency, or even worse, that there are significant numbers of civilian casualties, because in addition to repealing, revoking this Obama rule, the New York Times mentioned that he also is deemed, this being Donald Trump, large sections of Yemen and Somalia as, quote, areas of active hostilities, so that by declaring them part of war zones, even if they're not, then even with the old Obama rule in place, there's not a requirement to report on civilian casualties outside war zones because they're no longer, quote, outside war zones. So there, that part is not an Obama-motivated thing. So it's got to be what I said, don't you think? Either pro-secrecy or to cover up civilian casualties that they don't want us to know about. I mean, isn't that the likely...
Yeah, I think there's certainly enough sort of pieces of the puzzle here to put it together to say they want to take off the gloves in the struggle, particularly in Yemen and Somalia. You know, front page story in the New York Times talks about how Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization in Somalia, is really stepping up its attacks. There's a sense that there's a real surge in American airstrikes in the last 4 months that we're just starting to get more and more a piece of that puzzle. And I think, yes, I think they want to be more aggressive. I think they have been quietly aggressive, and they don't want to be held accountable for it. That's certainly a way we could put all the pieces of the puzzle together. But as I say, this president's moves. Remember, he said we will take the troops out of Syria. Then he decided, well, actually, let's look back at that. He said we will push forward and we will get, you know, a denuclearization deal with North Korea. And then he walked away from the deal and stepped back from that. I think the one thing we might want to learn from our brief history here with the Trump administration is we need to analyze, but to try to, you know, somehow understand motivation. I feel like I'm wrong every time I do that because it gets reversed or it gets changed. And what you end up with, the most clear picture, is an erratic presidency, an erratic foreign policy that goes back and forth. And that is as troubling as anything. And that, as I shared a couple weeks back, remember when I was in New York at the Council on Foreign Relations and talking to some real sort of big thinkers around security, and then in Maine at that meeting with a lot of people in intelligence officials who are gathered up there for this big meeting. I'm hearing consistently in meetings like that President Trump's foreign policy is one of the greatest security threats to our country because no one in the world can understand where it's going next. And that creates weakness, that creates instability, that concerns our allies, and that's something that, you know, is the net effect. We'll never know what his motivations are half the time, right? But the net effect is one that should concern us all.
So, Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth Project, there was this terrible tragedy where in the middle of a mass at a Catholic cathedral in the Philippines, two bombs exploded, killed 23 people. The Islamic State claimed credit for this. And this is all in the context of stories about the ISIS, about how ISIS is on the rise in the Philippines. What's happening?
Yeah, so the Philippines is a really dangerous place where there's always been Islamic militancy. We've seen it, you know, for many, many years there. But it really is spiking right now, and it's spiking under the brand of ISIS. And it's a disturbing development, and it's an example of how ISIS is not out of business. You know, the Trump administration has effectively pounded ISIS for sure in Syria and Iraq, and they've continued on the policies that President Obama and the Defense Department under President Obama got started. They've amplified them, and they've had considerable effect. How many civilians they've killed in the meantime, again, we need to keep that accounting very clear as well. But I do think it's fair to say they've had considerable impact. When they then say, we defeated ISIS in campaign rhetoric, they're completely wrong. ISIS will live as an idea. This is the long war. This is a generational struggle against an ideology, and that will be very difficult to put out of business, just as we've never put Al-Qaeda fully out of business. We brought them in check maybe here and there, but not out of business. ISIS keeps popping up. We're seeing it time and time again. Philippines is the new one. Just to remind people, there is a Muslim-Christian divide in the Philippines that is a kind of fault line.
And that's why? Because I was wondering why the Philippines...
Yeah, so the attack on the church, you know, largely Catholic country, right?
Yeah.
But it has a Muslim minority that is very militant, and there have been quite a few spikes in violence, particularly targeted at churches there. And Duterte, the leader of the Philippines, is a real sort of, you know, kind of has the same spirit of Trump around this kind of populist messaging that's really anti-Islamic and some would say Islamophobic. You know, this is why he is pounding those positions where ISIS is trying to gain a foothold after the attacks on the churches. And it's a kind of relentless pounding that really does play to a political divide in the country that can often be interpreted as a religious divide. These fault lines are always really complex, and they have a lot of micro fissures, and I hate to simplify, but there really has been a long and bloody struggle of Islamic insurgents in the Philippines, and they are trying to rebrand under ISIS, and I think it's going to heat up a lot. And I think we're seeing the same in Somalia, that there's a kind of rebranding under the banner, the black flag of ISIS. This is, like I said, this is the longest war in American history since 9/11, and it's showing no sign of ending anytime soon. It is the struggle of a generation, and we are in pretty deep into it. Longest war, as I say, in our history, but nowhere near over. And it's a war of ideas, and you have to approach it that way. And I sometimes worry when the administration doesn't understand the bigger war of ideas. And I hope there are good, sane, responsible voices who will continue to deepen that approach to the struggle against terrorism inside the Defense Department and inside the State Department.
Charlie
thank
thanks.
You very much.
Thanks, you guys. We didn't get to talk about Netanyahu, but we'll do that
we
next
ran
week,
out of time. We ran out of time.
The election's April 9th, right? Is that what it is, April 9th?
It's April 9th. So great piece in the Times. Today, just comparing Netanyahu and Trump and how they have this weird alliance. Anyway, we'll talk next week.
Yeah,
thanks,
I want to do
guys.
That for sure. Thanks. Did you see, by the way, part of the Times piece, Marjorie, is while Netanyahu is prohibited by election law to appear in any election video with Israeli troops, do you know who he's surrounded by in the most recent video? American troops, because Trump is so popular in Israel that's his election strategy to overcome these corruption charges with the election just a month away.
Yeah, the corruption charges, I mean, like getting expensive champagne and stuff, it seems a little lowbrow, doesn't it?
Well, some of it's not so lowbrow. In any case, we'll do that with Charlie Sennett next month.
Okay, Charlie Sennett joins us every week. He's a news analyst here. Did I say every week?
No, I said next month.
Right. Okay.
You didn't do anything wrong.
Every week. He is a news analyst here at WGBH, heads up the Ground Truth Project. Up next, we are opening the lines and asking you, Jim's obsession comes to the fore. When does the elder statesman become too elder? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. And we are in our Brighton studio, Studio 3.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, we open the lines and ask you, how old is too old to run for president? If we elect someone to office, don't we want the greatest assurance that he or she can see this thing through? With Biden at 76, Sanders at 77, and the average life expectancy in the U.S. being 78 years old, not to mention the depressing science of age. And we'll ask you, should age be a legitimate factor in this race?
Then Richard Bruton, one of Ireland's cabinet ministers, joins us to talk about the sticking point in the Brexit negotiations, the Irish backstop. We'll ask him what's at stake for peace between Ireland and Northern Ireland if there isn't a backstop breakthrough. Martin Luther King Jr. is getting his Boston Memorial. Should Malcolm X get his too? Jan All Revved Up will talk about this, the debate about anti-Semitism sparked by Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, and what Paul Manafort's sentencing says about white privilege. All that is next on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live local talk. Boston Public Radio.
It's Jim Bratty. I am Marjorie Egan. This is hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. How are you?
Excellent.
So it's time for the age-old question about old age. When is it too old to be the president? In the huge 2020 field, we have a handful of candidates who, according to science, and it's brilliantly put out by Linda Rodriguez McRobbie in an ideas section piece in yesterday's Boston Globe, are, and these are the facts, at least as a class, we're not talking about the individuals, are in the mental and physical decline. Doesn't matter how energetic they are. Doesn't matter if they can still endure the rigors of a campaign. Doesn't matter how smart and experienced they all may be. What matters is the unavoidable truth that they are slowing down. As we get older, our bodies and minds do start to deteriorate. I'm sorry. And with Bernie Sanders, Bill Weld, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, even Elizabeth Warren entering this physiological reality, is it time for us to reckon with this political one? 877-301-8970. And by the way, before, I'm sure we're going to aggravate a lot of people here, but before you call and say, what about you two? Isn't there a point you guys should get out of there? Well, I would answer that in the following way. Is when Nancy Pelosi, as it was mentioned in the Globe, forgot the name of Mitch McConnell in July of the Rolling Stones. It doesn't really matter if I forget the name. If I forget the name or Marjorie does, and you don't listen to the show, we'll lose our jobs. I mean, that's the way this thing works. When the Speaker of the House forgets the name of the majority leader in the Senate, it's a bit of a problem. What's that?
I didn't know this.
What's that? You didn't know that story?
No, I heard that one. I didn't know this one until I just read it.
What's that?
On a visit to Fort Myers following Hurricane Irma, the president announced that his wife, Melania, wished she could have been there to pay her respects. And she was standing right next to him.
Yes, exactly. Now, you know, maybe that's fatigue or something. The point is, physiologically, she talks, Linda Rodriguez McRobbie talks about the science of, you know, cognitive things.
That's right.
And memory decline. And they say one of the good things,
Jen, that she thing, right. Myelin, is that how you pronounce it?
I don't know how to say it. She does say she's balanced. She says one cognitive area that does seem to improve with age is the ability to see the whole picture. That's a good thing.
That's right.
But the reality is the bulk of the things
the
are bad.
Picture.
Not to mention life expectancy is such that, for example, again, this is not an anti-Bernie Sanders thing. He will be, I believe, 79 when he's sworn in, if he were to be elected president. His life expectancy would say he'd just make it through a second term. And by the way, my arguments on this age thing, you say I'm obsessed with it, have never been, almost never been about the science. My arguments have been you can't energize the hopeful young base of American voters.
Let me just finish that.
I know that Bernie Sanders did. I think he's aberrational, and maybe he's aberrational again. I think the difference maybe is when the three Democratic leaders of the House are all quite old. Mm-hmm. If the nominee's really old, I think it basically disenfranchises a lot of people. But the science, if you read this piece, even if you're on the other side of this, the science in McRobbie's piece is really,
really
compelling.
Well, what she says is that this slowdown starts in our 30s, but the effects become much more pronounced in the 70s and 80s. Ability to process new information, the areas of the brain implicated in memory making. And as I mentioned before, this white fatty substance known as the myelin sheath, whatever the heck that is, that coats and protects nerve fibers, thins. So people have a longer time remembering things. But some people are kind of just out of it. I think we could agree that Orrin Hatch, I mean, you have to kind
when
of...
When he asked that Zuckerberg
question? I'm not exactly a tech whiz over here.
I had noticed that, yes.
But, you know, if you don't know how Facebook operates, which is one of the biggest companies in the world, the most powerful companies in the world, and Orrin Hatch in that, when they had Mark Zuckerberg in there, and Orrin Hatch is 84, he has... retired,
yes.
Obviously, been replaced by Mitt Romney.
A mere kid.
But when he asked Mark Zuckerberg how the company made money, and Zuckerberg is sitting there and saying, well,
he practically laughed at him.
We run ads, yeah. Senator. I mean, that shows that you're not paying attention, which is, to me, worse than Pelosi forgetting McConnell or the president forgetting that Melania was standing right next to him. You know what I mean? That you're sort of out of it. It's like Dianne Feinstein. When all those kids came to her a couple of weeks ago,
yep.
They weren't all kids. They were grown-ups there. But there were a lot of children that came with her, came to her office and talked about the Green New Deal. And she seemed not to get their legitimate concern. They're living in California. It's got a coast, you know, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of miles. So to me, there's a difference, and that to me is the difference.
And also, one last thing here, and then we'll take your calls. In this piece by McRobbie in yesterday's idea section, one in six people over the age of 80 suffer from dementia. It's a significant rise from the one in 14 over age 65. It's a big deal. It is a big deal. And it's a big deal. 877-301-8970. And I know, by the way, people may say, wasn't there that one show on your former radio station? We're in the same 3 hours. Marjorie called you, and this is true, by the name of her dog. I'm not done. Her sister.
That's right.
Her son and her ex-husband.
That's right.
All in one 3-hour show. But you were young when you did that, that was not a function of old age.
My brain started going at an early age. ever since 20, it's been on the downhill slide.
What was your other thing?
But one last thing is, one of the incredible things I've always found, well, incredible, is looking at the President of the United States the day he was inaugurated and looking at him the day he left office. And whether it's a relatively young guy like Barack Obama or Bill Clinton,
any president, I'm sorry.
The toll, the physical toll, and you see this with Trump now, that he's looking worse and worse. Every president looks worse and worse.
You think he looks worse, Trump?
Oh, yeah.
Why, heavier?
Oh, heavier, jollier, just kind of – he's getting almost a hangdog kind of a look about him. And Barack Obama came in with black hair, left with salt and pepper, more on the salt than on the pepper. Same thing with George Bush. Same thing with any of them.
Your point is that it's a really intense, stressful job.
Well, is there any more intense and stressful job?
Well, except the only response I'd say to that, because I generally agree with you on that, is there are certain people – you and I are not amongst them – who respond well to that kind of incredible 24/7 stress. And some of these people who've been CEOs of the United States are probably amongst those people.
Like who?
I think it was William Henry Harrison. Oh, no, he only lasted a month. 877-301-8970. I think it's an issue. Apparently, lots of Democrats don't, because as we said to Steve Kerrigan and Jennifer Braceras in the 11 o'clock hour, if you look at the early polls in Iowa, there are two candidates who are running away from the field. It's not even close. And they are 76-year-old Joe Biden, who's not even a candidate, and 77-year-old Bernie Sanders.
Oh, one last thing.
Yeah.
I forgot to mention.
I think you said one last thing.
Health concerns. There was a lot of concern with when Sarah Palin became the vice presidential candidate with John McCain. Because John McCain had a lot of health issues.
Yeah.
Joe Biden has had two aneurysms in his brain, which is big deal stuff. So that might be a concern to people too. Are you worried about someone being able to withstand the rigors and make it through their term when they're at that age? And then, of course, the vice president becomes an even more.
What do you think of Jennifer Braceras' idea? 80. That's the cap. If you're going to be 80 in your term, you can't be president. Obviously, the Constitution would have to be amended. If you are 80, you have to retire as a Supreme Court justice at 80. Or
in
at
Massachusetts,
some age.
You have to retire 70. At 70 if you're from the Supreme Judicial Court, correct? Mm-hmm. Or I'm not sure if it's every other judge.
I don't know if it's others. I know the SJC
I could go to 75 on that because I do think people are – when you think of your own parents, I mean, maybe your parents were looking good in their old age. I mean, my parents never even made it, keeled over early.
Well, I have to say, even my parents made it till their 80s, to my knowledge. I can't swear to this. Neither my mother or my father ever called me by the name of their dog, their ex-husband, their sister, or their son. Well, I am was their son. Let's go to Charlie in Rhode Island. You're first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the age of the candidates and whether it matters. Hi, Charlie. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, you're
on.
Shoot.
Hi, Charlie from Newport.
We know that. Hi.
First of all, I'll just say I love your show. I love the discussions you all
have.
Thank
you. Thank
you, Charlie. I love Newport.
And I agree that the I think there should be a presidential age limit. I think the job is terribly demanding, unquestionably, and deterioration of cognitive function is unquestioned in age 70 and beyond, which is not to say that it affects everyone the same, but, I think that the country needs better and better leadership as time goes on, not worse and worse, as it were. But I would say also that I think that applies to Congress as well. We need term limits and we need age limits both.
We definitely need term limits. Absolutely.
The quality of discussions in Congress is deteriorating to the point now where I'm not even sure you could say there is decent discussion on most issues. I think that, we're rule-bound and age-bound and, precious little actually gets discussed in open forum.
Charlie, thank you
Thanks
very
for your
much.
Call.
Thank
we
you very much for the call. You know, they just flashed a poll from Iowa on CNN,
yeah.
And it was interesting. They broke it down into voters under 45 and over 45.
Mm-hmm.
And the only difference in the poll is that more people under 45 liked Elizabeth Warren. Biden and Sanders were way ahead in both polls, whether they're under or over. So sometimes I wonder whether you get more concerned about having older people when you're older, or if this doesn't, because Bernie Sanders had a young,
huge, yeah,
the so-called Bernie Bros. I mean, there were a lot of people in their 20s and 30s who called us to chastise us, and of course, in retrospect, they were right because we didn't. I didn't think he could. I never thought he'd get the votes that he did.
877-301-8970 is our number. Let's go to James in a car. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I am fairly concerned about our older candidates. It obviously can. I mean, they probably have to pick a pretty good vice president to make sure that, if they do die in office, that someone is able to take over for them that is fairly competent,
But you know what my concern, though, James, let me just say, I'm glad you brought up that point. If we had an opportunity to vote separately for vice president, even though obviously that won't happen because they may not be compatible, that'd be one thing, so that you and I and Marjorie could say, if John Doe, the president who's in his 80s, dies, Jane Doe becomes president, that's fine. But we don't really get to pick that person. Do you know what I mean? The presidential candidate in the convention essentially does. So, what's a good – I think John McCain lost votes because – Sarah Palin became such a laughingstock by the end of the campaign. Of course, that was his choice. So it cuts both ways, I guess. But clearly, the vice presidential nominee will take on much greater importance if a candidate who's going to be 80 in his or her term is the nominee. James, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. I'll also say for the 400th time I've said it, despite the way the Palin candidacy ended, I was in Minnesota about 100 feet away from her during that first speech, lipstick on a pig speech. It was one of the best political speeches I've ever heard in my life, and I thought she was the future of the Republican Party. Of course, it all went downhill from there.
She was a very talented politician, she never did her homework.
Exactly. But you didn't know that from the first speech was beautifully crafted, incredibly well delivered. She was really on fire
at
that thing.
Yeah, she was on fire. Jack, who keeps track of all your mandates, Jim.
Oh, what did I mandate now?
He says that on age limits, Jim appears to be gearing up for yet another mandate.
Actually, Jack, that is a very fine point. I will call you if I, but don't leave your number, but I will call you if I decide to mandate this. I think there actually should be an age limit. I happen to agree with Braceras on this. Dan in Fenway, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, thanks.
Hi, I believe both of you, I agree with both of you. I agree with Jim for sure, because, if Bernie Sanders is going to be 80 years old, the average age in America is about 37, 38 years old. What does he know that 38, what does he care for what a 38-year-old thinks? When Bernie Sanders was 30-something years old, there was Jim Crow laws in the South, and nowadays, there's such different things going on in the world. And then the other problem, too, is with the age does come, Donald Trump is obviously showing, not obviously, but he's showing signs of dementia or signs of problems with his, mind. And this is going to happen with, older candidates for sure.
Well, by the way, there was a wonderful piece. I'm so glad you said what you said at the end there because I'd forgotten. You remember the piece in Stat, which is the great it's not an offshoot. It's a part of the Globe, an online part of the Globe, deals with science, medicine, et cetera. Remember the piece where experts talked about Donald Trump's speech as a new president in the first years compared to Donald Trump's speech as a citizen in earlier years? And they made the point you did, Dan, not that he had dementia or anything like that, but that that diminution in oral capacity, for lack of a better expression, or the decline in oral capacity was a function of age. So, Dan, thanks for a fine call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. You know what my bet is? I haven't seen a poll around this issue. I know the poll you just mentioned in terms of Iowa. Mm-hmm. Remember when you and I used to campaign on the air and incur the wrath of the AARP saying that people over 75 should have to take a road test because if you pass at 16, you never take a road test in Massachusetts again? Do you remember what probably the demographic that most – this is anecdotal based on email and I don't know if we were doing Twitter then – email and phone calls, what demographic was most supportive of mandating road tests for older people?
I don't remember.
Older people.
Oh.
Who basically understood. This is, by the way, if you drive fine, you keep your license. If you don't
right.
drive fine, you don't keep your license.
Well, the point that the guy that from BU talked about having how I think it was an extraordinary number of people by 85 had serious dementia issues.
Well, I said, I just read it in this woman's column, 1 in 6
yeah.
over 80.
And I think it by 85, somehow 85 is a bad turning point or something. And the stories were always the same. You know, the AARP would point out, and they were right, that more fatalities were involved with young people, but that's because young people are driving.
Drive more.
Faster. Oh. You know, they're going 80 miles an hour. You don't see that many really old people going 80 miles an hour down the Mass Pike. But the inability to distinguish between the gas and the brake. If you get in your car and you're functioning normally and you realize that you have your foot on the gas, you almost instantaneously put it on the brake. But if you can't tell, you know, and if your reflexes are so slow that you can't move your foot until you've run over people at the checkout line at the supermarket or something.
Or that doctor's office you wrote about. Didn't you interview the woman who...
Yes, this was a terrible, terrible story where this woman drove into a hospital, went right
doctor's
into...
Doctor's office, wasn't it?
No, it was in front of a hospital
okay.
and took out a physician there. And I believe it was a receptionist. I'm not sure.
Killed them.
They were standing inside the hospital building. She came barreling right through. And I remember going to interview her about 6 months after this. And, you know, I'm not a psychologist. I'm just a normal person. But this woman was not compos mentis. It was so obvious. But I remember what she said to me, that she was unable to go anywhere because there are people that live at far reaches of cities and towns, and they don't have any kind of public transportation, and that these, you know, these jitneys that run around picking up people, they take forever to get it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So that was why she continued to drive long after she knew she shouldn't. But she was clearly not with it.
877-301-8970. Let's go to Charlie in Groton. Hi.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Excellent.
Listen, I think this is such an important election. The Democrats could run whoever at the top of the ticket, whether it is Biden, who's most electable. Then have a running mate, Gillibrand, Seth Moulton, who is wonderful, and let Biden retire after a year and step down, and then we have an awesome other president. I think it's so important that we win this election.
I hear you, Charlie, but you're not being serious about step down after 1 year. Is that what you're saying?
Hasn't Biden talked about that, serving term?
Oh, one term is not 1 year.
Yeah, not 1 year, but he's talked about limiting his...
No. I mean, is it horrible for a president to say, you know, after 2 years, I'm stepping aside? I think that's logical.
Well, I don't think we've ever had that, have we?
No, I think the only thing I can think of, Charlie, is that you might be in danger of becoming almost an immediate lame duck, and that you're not going to be able to wield the kind of power you need to wield, at least for your first term. But I do believe, and I should double check this, that he's talked about saying one and done.
Charlie, thank you, though, for your call. You know, the interesting point that was made in our discussion at 11 o'clock, which is why I fear that this will not be a conversation, which it should be. And by the way, if the voters decide, I am totally a pro small d democracy guy. If they say the best nominee is Joe Biden, I guess it'll be 77 then, or Bernie Sanders at 78, then so be it. But it won't even be a discussion, as they said, Braceras and Kerrigan said, with Donald Trump as the Republican nominee, assuming he is the Republican nominee, because he's going to be, what, 74 at that point? So it's two septuagenarians. Neither campaign is going to criticize the other one for their age when they're in the same age group. And I think at minimum, it is a legitimate topic of conversation for voters in this country. Jared and Haverhill, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for calling. Hi.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, so basically just wanted to call in about a couple points on Bernie Sanders. Obviously, he's definitely older. But the party, he's pretty much moved the party left. And
yeah,
I'm going to vote with policy, you know, more over age. And I know he'll pick a good, a younger vice president. He said he'd like to pick a younger woman as a vice president, if anything should happen to him. But if you guys haven't seen the way he runs around the country the last 5 years, constantly, you know, in all these different locations every other day, doing two rallies at a time, he's got pretty good energy.
That was a great call. Thank you very much. Great points. And we have a great email from Dan.
What's that?
I enjoyed the ideas piece yesterday in the Globe, and I had a great point about presidential candidates being too old. Unfortunately, I left the room, came back in, and can't quite remember what I read or what I was going to say.
877-301-8970. Let me be clear. I'm not saying it's the only criterion for selection. Of course it is not. It should be an issue. It should. Jared, thanks much for your call. We have time for one more. Allison in New Bedford. Hi.
Hi. Just really quick, I just wanted to make a couple of points, and I can take the comments off air. But I wanted to remind everyone that most millennials are not just 22 years old and in college. I was born in the early 80s, and a lot of my millennial friends are in their 40s. We've been in the workforce. We've been paying our taxes. We've been working really hard to try to create families for ourselves. We're adults. We are on social media. We're well-educated. We follow politics. And we know what's difficult for us is to be able to have the things that our parents had and raised us in and to be able to afford to make that work, especially with just one income. A lot of women, we have to think about being able to have children and being out of the workforce, that money not coming in, how are we going to pay our taxes? How are we going to afford, Medicare? Our health care. Yep. And so all of these are really very serious issues. And so I think the previous caller was correct when he looked at the policies over age. And if anything, Bernie Sanders' age speaks to his experience and probably works toward his capabilities of actually getting things done.
Don't hang up. You said you'd take your comments off the air. So it's of no concern to you that science doesn't apply, obviously, to every candidate. It applies to a class of people in a certain age group. It doesn't matter to you that science suggests that people in their 80s are in cognitive decline. It doesn't matter to you that life expectancy is such that there's a decent shot that an 80-year-old president would die in office?
Well, I think what matters to me is the work that would be getting done right away, and the president is very visible. We have had our president, not to be negative, but Reagan before the presidency, we assume sort of was not really getting taken care of by him so much by Nancy Reagan. Not that that's a good example. We don't want that to be our example for a president, but I think that sort of putting the cart before the horse. And I would like to see and hear things that support, the positive changes that we may be able to make.
I hear you. See,
and I think,
Allison, I'm not suggesting the cart goes before the horse. I'm suggesting the cart goes next to the horse. And that while one is considering what's the best policy, maybe it's a much more minor consideration, but that age at least be one. But you make a strong case, and we thank you very much for making it. Allison, thanks very much for the call.
Okay, we are out of time on this one, but thank you very much for your great calls and emails. Up next, ahead of St. Patrick's Day, we're looking at U.S.-Ireland relations with Ireland's Minister of Communications, Climate Action, and the Environment. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Tomorrow's the deadline to put Brexit to yet another vote. If it gets defeated, Parliament will vote on whether to leave the EU without a deal or to seek an extension. The primary sticking point in the latest negotiations has been the Irish border backstop, an aspect of the deal that guarantees no hard border between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland after the UK splits from the EU. But if there isn't a backstop breakthrough, what's at stake for Ireland and Northern Ireland relations? Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about this, U.S.-Ireland relations, and even the Boston-Ireland connection ahead of St. Patrick's Day, is Richard Bruton. He's Ireland's Minister for Communications, Climate Action, and the Environment. Minister, it's great to meet you.
So as Jim just said, the primary problem here seems to be this border backstop. So tell us what that means.
Well, the background to this is that, when Britain decided to exit, they entered into negotiations with the European Union, and there were a number of issues that had to be resolved before we moved to discuss a free trade agreement. And those included citizenship, the contribution of the UK that they would make as they exited. And the third pillar was that every party, including the UK, Ireland and the European Union, knew that we had to avoid a hard border. So the hard border was an insurance policy. If in the event of the future negotiations going wrong, that there would be at least a fallback, that we would not have a hard border. And the background to that, of course, is the Good Friday Agreement, the huge effort that has been put into to build peace in Northern Ireland. But also a very practical problem has arisen since Brexit is that we have no power sharing executive in the north. We have no north-south bodies. So it illustrates, you know, how things could go very wrong in a hard Brexit situation and the importance of this insurance policy to maintain stability.
Because Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom.
Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom.
And Southern Ireland is independent.
Is it?
And obviously everybody remembers the terrible warfare, the troubles and everything that went on there before we reached that agreement. So when you talk about a hard border, do you mean, what do you mean? Soldiers? Do you mean passports? Do you mean what?
Obviously, the background to this is, you know, if the UK leaves the single market, there will have to be some sort of control on goods crossing between one and the other. There will have to be control about regulations. If Britain have a different set of regulations than are acceptable in the European Union market, there would have to be checks on those. So that's where this arose. So the solution that Europe negotiating with the EU came up with was that Britain would remain in what they described as a customs territory if all else failed. And that's part of this withdrawal agreement. The difficulty is that some of the members of the Parliament in Westminster feel they may be trapped in a relationship with the European Union if they agree to this. But I suppose the counter-argument is that this is only an insurance policy. What the withdrawal agreement is really about is a gateway to negotiating a much fuller trading relationship. But the feeling is there has to be an insurance policy. If everything goes wrong, we can't jeopardise what has been achieved in Northern Ireland and between North and South. And we already see how Brexit has exposed fault lines both in British politics and in Northern Irish politics. And that has to be managed. And a key part of that is avoiding a hard border.
Are you optimistic about this? Because my understanding is that opposition to the backstop from a lot of pro-Brexit British lawmakers is the reason the deal was defeated in the first place. Is that not correct? And are you optimistic? Or
I think you have to be optimistic because I think I think some people have misread what the withdrawal agreement is about. I mean, the withdrawal agreement is only a precursor to a very full negotiation of the long-term relationship between Britain and the European Union. And what some people fear is by having an insurance policy, they would be trapped. But that is a very, very pessimistic view. And I think, Theresa May herself articulated the view that, the backstop, as it's called, if that was an insurance policy that would, if you like, collapse whenever a storm came along, it wouldn't be an insurance policy at all. So there is a different perception of this. It has been made difficult by the fact that, I suppose the Tory party are trying to keep their group together. So in more recent votes, the Tory party haven't stuck with the withdrawal agreement that they negotiated. They are trying to find changes, tweaks to that deal, and that discussion is going on and will go on right up till Tuesday. So the hope will be that some reassurance can be given to British politicians that there is no intention to trap the UK in an arrangement of any sort that is not of their, not the direction they want to go.
That's the voice of Richard Bruton, who's Ireland's Minister for Communications, Climate Action and the Environment. We had Patrick Radden Keefe here. Did you read his book, Say Nothing, that came out recently?
I missed that.
It's good.
He's from The New Yorker, and it gets into the McConville
Gene McConville murder,
yes. And it also
Jerry Adams
back and forth from the times of the Troubles to now. He said to us he thought there is great anxiety about what happens on this backstop from his visits in the last couple of years. Is there great anxiety?
Well, reigniting the hostilities.
Yeah.
I think there's great anxiety about the risks of a disorderly exit of Britain. I think there's huge anxiety about that. It would, it provokes the possibility of a a hard border, but it also would provoke a complete breakdown in economic relationships between Britain and the continent, between ourselves and Britain. Like, take traditional agricultural industries, they would no longer have open access into the Europe, into the UK market, which would be still 40-50% of their market would be in the UK. They could face barriers. But also there's a problem with a lot of our goods going to Europe go through a land bridge through the UK. Suddenly they would face huge delays in Calais, between Dover and Calais, not being able to get through their traditional route. So the disruption of this will be massive, apart from the political fallout.
Can you play Nostradamus for a second? If there was a second vote today, what do you think that vote would be on Brexit and why?
I wouldn't bank on any different outcome, because I think the difficulty with the original vote was I think people voted not exactly on the question they were asked. They were asked, how do you feel about Europe? Mm-hmm. They probably answered a question, how do I feel? And they didn't feel good after a long recession. And I think, you know, this wasn't all about, you know, weighing the evidence and seeing what was best for the United Kingdom. I would fear that a new fresh referendum would be run against a backdrop where the blame game would be going on, and people would say, you know, those guys in Brussels ganged up on us. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any guarantee that a fresh referendum would see a different outcome. I think it's much more important that we work on long-term relationships that can be sustainable between the Britain and the European Union. And I think that's what the withdrawal agreement is, the gateway to doing that. There's no shortcut, I think. Now, they may vote for an extension of time, as you said at the top of your programme, which would give more time to find a resolution.
We're talking to Richard Burton, who's the Minister for Communications, and we're talking obviously about Ireland and Brexit and what's going to happen in Ireland with the fallout from Brexit. If you are, if you live in Galway now and you want to go to Belfast, do you just go, or is there anybody asking you for any kind of ID? How does it work now?
Well, no, there is a common travel agreement, and that is sustained. That will not change. So there's going to be no
back and forth.
There's no barrier to people moving, or people going to study, or people going for any reason. The issue will arise around goods and services and the regulation. If you have different set of regulations operating in Northern Ireland than in the South, you will have to have some checks. You'll take an extreme example. Some hormones in beef are not allowed in the European Union. If the UK started to import beef that had hormones, you know, there would have to be some check to prevent them entering the European market. So that's where the issue of how you're going to organise these checks. So the original proposal was that the island of Ireland would be treated as a common area for regulation, so such hormone beef couldn't come into either north or south. And that was the original proposal. That was thrown out by Britain because they felt that that created a boundary between Northern Ireland and the rest of Britain. So what they went for was a customs territory. So Britain and Northern Ireland would remain in the customs territory to avoid that sort of thing, unless something better was negotiated. But that now has proved a problem to get acceptance of that approach in Westminster.
You know, let me ask you a really stupid question about this whole Brexit situation.
It's a hell of an introduction,
Marjorie. Well, because from afar, it seemed that what people were objecting to was this Brussels running everything from far away and not having a say in what Brussels did and feeling very disenfranchised. But that, there wasn't any, I don't know, and you can tell me, why not focus way back when this all began on that aspect instead of this massive overhaul?
Yeah, I mean, a lot depends on how you look. I mean, every decision that is taken in Brussels has been taken by every member state sitting down together and thrashing it out. So in Ireland, we would regard the European Union as offering an opportunity for us to influence these decisions who are going to impact on us. We sit at the table, we have our vote, we thrash out the detail. I think the perception in Britain would be different. They would feel that, you know, even though they participate in all those decisions, a lot of the time they are resentful of Europe-wide decisions, and they, you know, they feel that they would like to, you know, shake free of that. Now, a number of years ago, when William Hague, the then leader of the, he was previously leader of the Tory Party, he did, if you like, an audit of what were these problems. And in truth, they were very slim. There weren't very many issues that were really proving difficult. But I think it has become more of a psychological difficulty that I think Britain wants to go a different way. They don't, you know, the populist media there has a long time chipped away at the European approach. And that's not to say Europe is perfect. It is like any governing system. I'm sure Washington has the odd barb thrown at it from time to time, you know, from discontented member states. But it's not a perfect institution, but at
not
the same
from discontented states, discontented citizens in the United States.
Well,
more...
you know what's interesting: the influence of Rupert Murdoch, both in the United States through Fox News and to a lesser degree the New York Post, and the influence in Great Britain because he runs the tabloid business in Great Britain.
Yeah, and it is a deep fault line within the Tory Party. I studied for a couple of years in the UK, and you know, this notion of the sovereignty of Parliament is a very strongly held view, and it runs very deep in the UK. So that they, it doesn't come easy to them, to the idea that you sit down at a multilateral system and work things out. So there has always been, I think, that fault line, particularly in the Tory party, that never was fully reconciled to the European Union. And I think that has, you know, that fault line has been hugely exposed. And it is along that fault line that the difficulties with the withdrawal agreement are arising. It is those, you know, that view of Britain who, you know, balk at the idea that they will still be in a customs territory, even if it's only an insurance policy.
Speaking of withdrawal, the second part of your jurisdiction, Minister for Communications, Climate Action and the Environment, second and third, Paris Climate Accords, obviously we are out. How difficult is it to do your job effectively when the United States is going in a totally different direction under Donald Trump, Minister?
Well, I was at the conference in Poland, the UN conference in Poland, which is a follow-up to Paris. And yes, it's true, you know, the US has pulled out of contributing. They're no longer bound by the Paris Agreement, but they were still there.
But were we celebrating fossil fuels at that conference?
No, you weren't. And, you know, I think the sense I get is a number of the cities and states here in the US are very committed to meeting the climate challenge. So while in the short term, it is certainly disconcerting that, you know, the US is not part of the agreement, I see a lot of good things happening in the US and a lot of leadership on climate action happening in the US. So I'm not entirely despondent about that. And I suppose we have to get our own house in order. Like, we're not perfect as the Irish economy has recovered. We've discovered we haven't broken the connection between prosperity and climate and carbon dioxide emissions. So we're going to have to do a lot of work. That's actually the job I've been given, that I have to get us back on track and hit our target of 30% reduction by 2030. So that's a big challenge for us.
How do the Irish people feel about Donald Trump? I remember this morning I just Googled quickly a poll. There's a large smile on the minister's face as I ask. And there was a vote in a poll in late 2017 where 70% of the Irish people were against a state visit by the United States president. How do they feel about Donald Trump in whatever month this is, March of 2019?
Well, I think they regard him as a pretty unique president. You know,
that's so diplomatic.
Well, he definitely has mastered a form of political communication that has that traditional politics has failed to do, and he has reached into a sort of a vein of communication that others didn't, and you know, it does represent a need for, you know, politics of the centre, if you like, to to reassert itself in some ways. So I think people will learn a lot from what has happened. It's been a big change in traditional US approach to international institutions in particular. But I would never be one to criticise the choice of another nation. You know, he has brought significant change here, and you know, we in the European Union obviously have to. You know, one of the things that I was done a lot of work on was the trade agreement between the US and the EU, and I thought it was a very valuable progressive instrument that would have brought prosperity. Now that is gone. I feel that's a loss. I think that relationship between the European Union and the US is a very important long-term relationship. We need to build ways of trading, standards in goods and services that are shaped by the West. And we now hear a lot of criticism of China and the way they might be, the criticism of Huawei. I mean, I think the best barrier to that is having a strong agreement between the United States and the EU about the sort of standards we apply, and that's a better route. But if we have to argue for that, we have to convince people that that's the right way to go. And I know a lot of people in the US, felt that America First was the right policy. But I would say contrary to that, like take our own relationship with the US, we have nearly as many people in the US employed by Irish companies as are mm-hmm. employed in Ireland by US companies. So there's mutual gains from trade. And I think, those connections have to be built upon, frustrating as they can be from time to time. And I think, Donald Trump has, he tapped into that sense of frustration that's there. And that's important. I mean, the European Union has its own challenges. So we are facing fractures within the European Union. The old ideal of, the European Union after the war, turning coal and steel into plowshares, which was a great vision. It's lost its impetus, and we have to regain that.
We're talking to Richard Bruton, who's the Ireland's Minister for Communications, Climate Action and the Environment. One last thing, a much more positive, easy note. The relations with Boston, I assume, the Ireland-Boston connection is same as it ever was.
It is. I just came from the New England Council this morning.
Oh, you did.
I did indeed. And, we were just talking about the strength of that relationship, not only economic but political. So many of your politicians have Irish backgrounds. There's so many close family connections still. People, new generation Irish who've come, particularly during the crash, they found a very welcoming home here in Boston and were able to create a life for themselves when things were very bad in Ireland. And, a lot of our Irish companies, are finding their first footfall in trying to enter the Irish market would be to put feet down here in Boston and build from there. So the relationship is as strong as ever.
One last thing about this. I don't know if you remember, Marjorie, when Mayor Walsh was on our show immediately after he had returned for his first trip to Ireland as mayor, he was as emotional as we've known him for a long time, as I have ever seen him. It was really an incredibly moving experience.
Yeah, and
him.
He was in Connemara, and he loved that. Yes. He had beautiful pictures of up there. And
well, I was reminiscing myself when I was a child. I remember John Fitzgerald Kennedy coming to Dublin. And he had the great tan and the white, beautiful cufflinks and cuffs. And this was a man, really, he inspired us. And, he said at the time, he talked about quoting Shaw, some people look at things and ask why. Mm. And I dream of things that might be and ask why not. I think that sense of inspiration that he brought to us was something that triggered huge change in Ireland. A new sense of optimism emerged after that. We opened up, we abandoned the protectionism mm-hmm. of decades and opened up to a new vision. And so our strength is really built on the two pillars of membership of the European Union and our close relationship with the United States. They're the pillars that have created the sort of new Ireland that has emerged. And the other thing I've commented on, which is interesting, he was an Irish emigrant made good who became president of the United States. We now have a prime minister who is the son of an emigrant.
All right. Which is,
oh, yes.
Yeah, right.
Which is, it's a remarkable feature of the change that has occurred in Ireland.
It's a pleasure
well,
to meet you, Minister.
Thanks so much
for your time.
It's wonderful
thank
to talk to you. Richard Bruton is Minister of Communications, Climate Action and the Environment. Thank you again for coming in. Up next, it is time for All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Let me just say, if I seem upbeat in this segment, it may be in part because I'm fairly fond of our two guests. But the real reason, Marjorie, is what?
I just told you I had a half a cheeseburger in the back seat of my car.
It doesn't get much better than that. With all due respect to the reverends,
that's all right.
Of course.
I'm going to do a drive-by with a cheeseburger
here
after
with
the
us,
show.
You better believe it. Here with us in Studio 3 to take on the moral dilemmas of the day. They understand my position. Our Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. They join us every Monday for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston Voice for Detours African American Heritage Trail, visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at BU School of Theology. Emmett is professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary. Irene, Emmett, good to see you.
Thanks for having us back.
And glad to be here.
Excellent.
So as everybody knows, or most people know, we now have a plans for a Martin Luther King Memorial and Coretta King Memorial on Boston Common. The two enjoined hands were chosen.
Four
enjoined hands, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you're right, were chosen, I think, last week or the week before. So that's going to be – but as Renee Graham points out in another terrific column by Renee Graham, why not a Malcolm X monument too? And I was thinking, Irene, I don't know if you'd go for this, but we were talking about the autobiography of Malcolm X.
That's
one
right.
of the many things I learned is that no one could do the Lindy Hop like Malcolm X. Now, would that be disrespectful to have him kind of in midair doing the Lindy Hop?
Well, he was a terrific dancer.
I guess
was. But also known for being a great orator. I'm very excited about this monument for a couple of reasons, because I remember we've had a previous conversation and we had talked about, I said I thought we needed to honor all three of them, put them all together here. But so he'll have a separate one. Which
you actually did say that.
Yes,
that's
we did.
Right,
we talked about that for at length here. I'm delighted about it because I have
to
say.
We don't know we're going to have it yet. You talking about the MLK one or the Malcolm one?
The Malcolm one.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm excited about it for a couple of reasons. One, he is as close to Boston's native son as you could really think of.
More when you think about it. More than MLK.
Absolutely. His autobiography is a black man's urban talking book, and his actual life as he navigate, particularly through Boston, is a green book.
Yeah.
How do you navigate and not do some of what he has done, you know? And so I think I'm just very excited about it.
What, are you on board?
I'm trying to figure out what she's excited about. I think
the possibility, the thought of it. I mean, you have
the
to start.
The proposal, the informal proposal.
Yeah, you have to start there.
Of course. I think we need to start the process of organizing and creating a little pressure on City Hall. I think Renee Graham's piece is right on the money. I think Renee's a phenomenal writer
and
a phenomenal researcher to pull all this stuff together. Malcolm X, or Malcolm Little, as he was known here, had a phenomenal, you know, experience and kind of he is the redemptive story, if there is one. You know, regardless of people agree with his politics or his policy or his religious position, he is a redemption story. And so I think that is one of the reasons why we should have.
And the interesting thing is, black urban boys, believe it or not, resonate more with Malcolm's narrative, you know, kind of, you know, up from the hood kind of narrative.
Well, it was a
then they do certainly.
I
was just going to say, you know, it just wasn't. And I found this hearkening back to that time where people went to these big dance halls. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously it was it was segregated, which is not the way to do it. But that was such a different time where there was all this activity all through all that whole Mass Ave area and all these great places to hang around, the neon lights nightclubs.
Yeah, it's the second biggest one to Savoy down in Harlem.
Yes.
So there would be traffic
which
back
I didn't
and forth.
Even know.
Oh well, you know, we have this book called Miss Anne in Harlem. So you would be a kind of Miss Anne in Harlem, white women who come up there to, you know, take the A train up to Harlem, and they had many.
And he talked about that.
Absolutely, and that's how he meets the white woman that he meets.
Wait a second, we have told you the story.
What story?
During the Republican convention
in
2004.
Oh, tell
Marjorie
me everything.
And I went to dinner with two of our coworkers to Sylvia's, which mm-hmm. is obviously a legendary restaurant
in Harlem.
In Harlem,
yeah.
And as we're walking back to the subway, I don't know why she doesn't like the story. It happened. Corey, who was one of our producers, who was a young African American kid, looked at Marjorie and said, "Marjorie, I want you to know, you are the whitest woman who has ever been in Harlem." So, I mean, whatever.
Okay.
You know, can I tell you one more thing about this? I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I will, since I think I have in the past. I had no idea how deep King's and Coretta King's, Scott King's connection to Boston was until Liz Walker and Paul English, who started this monument thing, were on the show with us and told me about it. I had no idea till I read, even though I didn't make it to the book club for reasons we won't get into, I had no idea how deep Malcolm X's connections were to Boston.
Yeah, you must
until
never
I read
met,
the autobiography.
Have you ever met the minister of 12th of 12th Baptist?
Which one?
Thompson? Michael Haynes.
Oh, hey. I met Haynes once.
Because when you meet him, he kind of tells you the story of King and Coretta.
But you know what else was and not only was he here for, he got here when he was 15, lived in his sister Ella's house, talks a lot about the neighborhood.
That's right.
He was in the high on the hill blacks and the low on the hill blacks and all that kind of stuff, and talks about all the fun in Boston. But he also, I mean, the fact that he was in the Norfolk prison, which was a very progressive prison, and
that's
had
right.
that
library.
Debating club
the
and the rich guy that donated mm-hmm. all those books, yeah. enabling him to go to become.
Well, it helped his oratory skills. Well, in many ways.
Also, he had 6 years to read and read and read.
But you know what the shameful thing is? That's a classic example of school to prison pipeline. It's a shame that he got a better education in prison while being incarcerated than he could possibly in a Boston public school or Michigan or even in Nebraska. So that's the sad thing about it.
But clearly that can't be the reason for the statue, because you'd be giving statues to a whole lot of African-American males. And I don't say that
right.
in jest.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that in jest. I think this is where we got to be careful of revisionist history. Malcolm X was phenomenal because of what he did at Mosque 11, Boston's Mosque 11, within the Nation of Islam, and what he did to so many people in terms of inspiring and challenging them to think about what they believed. And part of that was his ability to be challenged about what he believed.
Yeah.
And so whether he stayed at, you know, old Charlestown State Prison or MCI Concord or MCI Norfolk, those are kind of locations. But what we honor is the transformation of a person, of a man who really stood for something. And him and King were not that diametrically opposed as they've been juxtaposed in history. They were actually closer.
More colleagues than not.
Absolutely.
The interesting thing is...
But as Evan says, so far we're celebrating a column.
That's essentially what we're doing so far.
But
I'm excited about it. I mean, Malcolm gives us many things. The first time we could even embrace the notion and hear it as we gasp in disbelief of a notion of a black theology. He was the first to ask even black Christians, why are you honoring a God that does not look like you? We're the only ones that are doing that here. So he gives us a black theology. He moves from the Nation of Islam to become a Sunni Muslim. He no longer says this, Marjorie, as I look at your blue eyes.
Intersectionality?
Okay. No. I got you groomed so well here.
Oh, the blue-eyed devils.
The blue-eyed devils. Absolutely.
I was taking some affront at that. But also, you thought about King, who had kind of a middle-class upbringing. Yeah. You know, he had a very distinguished parents. And Malcolm had this disastrous childhood.
So you know what it tells you?
His father's murdered by white people.
What
his mother.
You know what it tells you? It doesn't matter what rung in society, where you are in terms of black life, if you're black middle class or you're a black person who comes from his kind of deprivation, life is hard for black men as well as for black women.
Yeah.
Okay? Because the bigger thing, that overarching thing, that they're so King's middle class couldn't protect him. And the stings were just as painful. It's just you're growing up in Jim Crow America.
Yeah, I just found the arc of King of Malcolm's life to be fascinating, you know, and the trip
two geniuses
to Mecca, yeah. and seeing a different sort of life than he'd ever seen, interaction.
Oh yeah,
that he'd ever
you know,
seen.
Irene, you said a minute ago, Jim Crow America. Speaking of Jim Crow America, that's how some people are describing Manafort versus the rest of the world. With this sentence, 47 months, the other day we talked a little bit earlier. And while most of the people who've been commenting on this have been commenting saying people who are not wealthy and connected don't do nearly as well, people of color obviously don't do nearly as well either. You know, there's some amazing statistics. I was reading a piece. There's this 2018 study called Judicial Politics and Sentencing Disparities. And it talks about the number of 62% of the population in this country is white. 79% of the federal judges are white. And it goes on to say, and this is not surprising at all, found that white Republican-appointed judges sentence black people to much longer prison sentences mm-hmm. than black judges or even white Democratic judges. And so the only good thing, I think, that came out of the Manafort sentencing is people who never think about sentencing disparities with all kinds of demographic groups are finally focusing on, not finally, are focusing on this at least a little bit this week, Emmett.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's nothing that good came out of this. I mean, I think, you know, Black Twitter, and Irene has mentioned and invoked Black Twitter many times, but there's a gentleman by the name of Muhammad Saleh who had a tweet, and he mentioned three very, very important cases. Khalif Browder.
Yes, please.
Oh, we talked a lot about
him. Oh, my God.
You know, Bronx, you know, 2010, allegedly stole a backpack, got 3.5 years in prison until his trial.
Much of which was in solitary.
In solitary.
By the way,
he ended up committing suicide.
And he was, what, 16?
He was 15.
Yeah.
15. He ended up committing suicide. Fate Winslow was a homeless man in Louisiana who was promised a $5 commission to help sell a $20 a bag of weed, was given life, okay? Mm. And then Crystal Mason in Texas, a black woman who voted
while
she
was
on probation. That's right.
And she gets 5 years.
That's right.
And by the way, she didn't even realize testimony credibly that she couldn't vote because she was still on probation.
And data has shown that black men have a 20% longer prison sentence. Yeah. And, you know, the thing is, the motto is, someone told me when I was pastoring at home back in New York, we wanted this young black guy who didn't do a crime to be represented. And the lawyer just said flat out, he says here that if you want justice, how much do you want to pay? And of course, we knew then how bankrupt the system is. But, you know, black men are easily seen as criminals. So they're automatically, you know, thrown into what we call mass incarceration, which is big money. They become cheap labor. To me, it disenfranchised men similarly to me as the Dred Scott case in 1857, where you had no protection under the law.
Can I get back to this Khalif? I have to say, I'm not at all suggesting that that case is more important than the other two.
Yeah.
We had the woman on, Jennifer Gonerman,
awful.
Who wrote
She's
the piece
awful.
For The New Yorker.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you want to read just one piece about the grotesque inequities in the criminal justice system, I don't think anybody ever
dispute
expressed
that.
It
yeah.
better than this woman did talking about this young man.
That's right.
And
by the way, he maintained that he never stole the black.
He was never even tried.
That's right.
And he wasn't going to confess to something that
he hadn't done.
Do.
That's right. Exactly.
That's right. And he gets beaten up in prison. I mean, really, the fact that he was able to hold himself together as long as he did is a miracle.
His last name was Browder, by the way. B-R-O-W-D-E-R, if you want to check it out online. We're talking to Irene Monroe and Emmett Price.
Well, we're also talking about, I think, a double standard situation in terms of the reaction to Representative Ilhan Omar. She's the one that was called anti-Semitic for the things that she said about the Americans' relationship to Israel. And then she said, this is one of her quotes, "I should not be expected to have allegiance, pledge support to a foreign country," meaning Israel, "in order to serve my country." There was a big brouhaha about this. And as many people have pointed out, There has not been such a brouhaha about the president, you know, when he's wanted to ban Muslims from the country, or said that George Soros, who's Jewish, was funding this caravan across the border and praised white supremacists, et cetera.
Well, how about the ranking oversight Republican Jim Jordan.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Refers in a tweet to Tom Steyer, the guy who you see on TV all the time. By the way, I have him on TV with me on Wednesday on Greater Boston.
Oh.
Tom Steyer has been leading the impeachment charge. He spells his name, the S in Steyer, with a dollar sign. Steyer happens to be Jewish.
Yeah.
No one called for I have to say that while I think we do need a more balanced policy in this country around Israel, particularly around what the Palestinians are suffering through in the living conditions, I think the choice of words on Omar's point were wrong, frankly. This, you know, this all about the Benjamins, she says,
it's
all about money.
Yeah, the tropes that she used, to bring her point
but
across.
But there's got to be a level playing field. And I know you think Nancy Pelosi is the most brilliant speaker in the history of the world and how brilliantly she shot down Donald Trump in those budget negotiations. I think the handling of this thing, this whole anti-Semitism, was a disaster.
But the resolution is condemning not just only anti-Semitism, but Islamophobia.
I know that.
But you got to
start. But it was a CYA kind of thing on the part of the Democrats after they got in trouble around the Omar thing.
Yeah, but I think you have to start somewhere here. And the point is, we will never forget Donald Trump when he was running, you know, for president. And remember, he said he had the dollar signed. He was talking about Hillary and her campaign fund. And then he also had the Star of David. And he said, no, I thought it was a sheriff badge here. You have to start somewhere here. And I think that they're doing a good example of now we will no longer tolerate any of these kind of speeches. You know, unfortunately,
of course they will tolerate them. No one said a word about Jordan
at all.
This is purely because there was some concern they were going too far on Omar. And so what they decide is let's water it down. You don't consider water down. I respect your opinion. I happen to disagree. They passed a watered down resolution in the hopes that they could escape the crisis that they themselves created.
So let's back up a step, because first of all, there's a huge population in the country who do not believe that she should be a representative because of her faith.
I agree with that. I agree that there is a huge percentage of the population.
And so the fact that she has a different perspective and a different articulation of her own perspective that's different from the mainstream Americana narrative is an issue for a lot of people. The second thing is that she's 37 years old. And so her lingua franca and her use of about the Benjamins is going to be more about hip hop and more about that kind of jargon or paraphrase than it would be about some kind of analysis of about Benjamins and $100.
Okay.
I mean,
I disagree. And
then the third piece is anti-Semitic is about hostility to or prejudice against Jews, right? She's talking about policies in many ways, and the United States' policy of being so friendly to Israel, right? Not necessarily Jewish people, but to Israel. And anti-Palestinian, so I think there's a lot of conflation
now, you see,
going on here.
I was going to agree with you until your second point for two reasons here. If he doesn't like Netanyahu's policy, say that. You do not have to use an anti-Semitic trope to bring your to confiscate. I mean, to confound the issue. That's what I mean. To confound the issue here. That the Benjamin is problematic because it is the trope of Jewish people and money. I think
when Diddy uses nothing but the Benjamins, he's talking about Jewish people?
But
really?
Diddy's not in Congress.
That's right. See, that's the point. Diddy is not in. I actually agree with you.
Whoa.
Wow.
So then all congressional representatives need to speak as if they're. So this is politics of respectability.
No, it is
so then
not.
The president
it's
should speak
clarity.
Like a president.
No.
Congressmen and congresswomen should speak like congressmen.
It's about clarity. But what you're not addressing is that it is anti-Semitic. And there are ways in which to bring her point across that she could have done that. I'm not talking about a politic of respectability. I'm talking about anti-Semitism. And I need to say this. Anti-Semitism is so pervasive in this country. We have normalized it. It is invisible. And we don't recognize when it is present.
It's like
and
Jim and Jane Crow.
Well,
both
wrongs don't make a right. But my point is, it needs to be addressed. And where we do address racism a lot in our language, we do not around anti-Semitism. So to get back to Jim's point, while it is anemic in its intent as a CYA, it is moving in the right direction.
And this is why the majority of your Democratic presidential candidates are 60 and above.
Well, then, see, to me, that's another anti-Semitic statement.
How's it anti-Semitic?
Joe Biden's not Jewish.
Okay. Because that is, what are you assuming?
I'm not assuming. I'm looking at the numbers.
Are you assuming that younger folks are more, because of their quote, hip-hop language,
they're going to be
anti-Semitic?
Words change, phrases change over time and over generations.
No, it doesn't.
There are some things
we've
that folks
said this
who
about
are over
the N-word, and that has not changed.
It has.
I disagree. It has
that's
not.
That's why it's pervasively used by young people.
We will not agree. Can you explain to me why the first meeting of the head of the Mormon Church, and I don't mean this facetiously, which has, what, like 10 million or 16 million people, and the head of the Catholic Church with a billion people is as big a deal as, and maybe it is. I don't mean this
I think it's a huge deal.
Why is it a big deal?
Largely because, first of all, a lot of people don't think of Mormons as Christian. I think to have a kind of relationship or even a conversation with the Catholic Church that is the emblem of Christianity and having a
conversation. It is a big deal.
It is a huge
deal. If I didn't finish my thought, it's the first meeting between the leaders of the
church. That's
right. Churches.
I think that is huge because meaning Mormons, have had a credibility issue forever. And so to have this moment come together, I mean, it's like Malcolm and King. It's big.
What do you think of it? Do you agree?
I think it's big if they're going to talk about, you know, sexual assault. They're going to talk about all the different things that both of them have in common.
Yeah.
And that's,
you know,
every church.
Lack of equality of women and lack of safety and security of women. If they're going to talk about that, then it's a huge deal, and I'm all in.
I kind of say amen to Emmett on that one.
You
I
do?
Agree. Yeah, I agree with him
you
on that
such
one.
Such a flip flopper.
Okay.
Was that anti-Semitic? That's all you.
No, that wasn't.
Okay.
But we can continue that other conversation out at the parking lot.
Before you go to the parking lot,
can
I pitch Alex's book before? It's the only book I've ever read on Mormonism.
Oh yes,
which is great. Alex Beam wrote several years ago, "American Crucifixion: The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church."
Yeah, that is a good book.
It's a really good book. Go ahead, Margie.
No, I was just going to say. I don't know, and I should know. Polls about among Jewish Americans, if younger Jewish Americans are more critical of the policies, they are.
Absolutely.
They are.
Yeah,
but they're not using anti-Semitic language to critique it.
Right.
And that's the point that I'm trying to make to my colleague here to my left.
I'm going to do some research to see how many younger folks in this population are using the metaphor about the Benjamins.
Okay, please do.
Thank you.
So why don't you come back next week and let us know.
Assignment.
Is that okay? Well, since he's not watching NFL games, and what else you not watching? And not listening to Michael Jackson.
Lots of people, I think, are not listening to Michael.
I have plenty of time.
Did you guys see Kenan Thompson do R. Kelly on Saturday
Night? Oh, my God.
Was
he was wonderful.
Brilliant?
Absolutely.
If you haven't seen it was the cold open 7
that
minutes.
And Leslie Jones.
He was
excellent
brilliant.
Here.
Yep. See you guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
We are, that was the Reverend Zaire Monroe and Emmett G. Price III. They join us every week for All Revved Up. Irene is a syndicated religion columnist, the Boston's voice of Detour's African American Heritage Trail, a visiting researcher in the Religion and Conflict Transformation Program at Boston University School of Theology. Emmett is a professor and founding executive director of the Institute for the Study of the Black Christian Experience at Gordon College. Conwell Theological Seminary. Coming up, we are opening the lines and ask, could you quit Donald Trump? That conversation is next on 8970 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're about 6 days, I think, into the season of self-denial, Lent. Some people give up candy, the crossword, or cocktail hour. Alex Beam, in his column, says he's giving up the commander-in-chief. In his latest piece, Alex writes about giving up his Trump fix for Lent, the tweets, the rallies, the Mueller report, all of it. When you look at how far-reaching Trump's tentacles are, it's a challenge to live Trump-free. We know that. We're taking your calls and asking you, could you do it at 877-301-8970? Would you feel better if you could quit Trump? Like Alex, are you hooked on him, or is it our civic duty to be vigilant about everything the guy does? 877-301-8970. Every year I'm not doing it this year. Don't worry. I know it upsets you. I asked Margie what she gave up. She doesn't like that question, so I'm not going to ask.
Thank you.
I know. I figure for 1 year I'll take a break because Alex has it. Did you see Alex's column? Does he interview somebody who says what they've given up for Lent is hope? Which that was a pretty good line. We want to know, could you give up Trump? We've mentioned her a million times. We had a Pulitzer Prize winning author, Jennifer Egan, who was great. And is really smart and really together. We're talking about her latest book at the time. This is about a year ago. And she said to us, she turns off the news when Trump is on. She's reading the paper. She just can't handle it. And Alex is, when is Lent over? April 18th? Is that what
April
it is?
18th.
So Alex is talking about just for, you know, a month and a week or whatever it is. Could you do it? Would it be good for your mental health? Is it irresponsible?
Oh, yes.
Is it a civic kind of thing?
Oh, no, it would be good for your mental
health. You couldn't do it for an hour,
well,
could you?
Forget your job.
Could you do it as a citizen of the world, Marjorie Egan?
Well, what I could do is limit the amount of time per day, you know, that I'm getting the Trump. I mean, do you have to get the Trump alerts on your phone? Do you have to watch 3 hours of cable TV every night? Do you have to, like, record all the news shows on Sunday morning? I mean, it gets a little over the top and crazy.
Could you do it for one day?
Do you have to Google Trump every 2 seconds?
Could you do it for one day?
Yes.
No, you could not.
I could.
You could just, every Trump story, you just... You click on to the next story. You'd avoid it. When he comes on CNN,
you know what I
can do? 24.
Just take a news break day. Take a Sabbath from the news, Jim. A news free Sabbath. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
You think Alex is serious about this, by the way? He'll be in, I assume, in a day or two.
Nah, I think he just thought I could get a good column on it.
877-301-8970. Could you give up Trump for Lent or anything else? And would you like to give up Trump? We don't mean get him out of office. We mean essentially stop following him. You don't follow him on Twitter, do you? I do.
I do.
I have
on my phone. I think people feel the resentment about how much space he takes up in their brains. You know, that there's a real addiction to this guy, and they just can't get away from him. And you can't live a normal life anymore because you are addicted to Donald Trump, either in a good way or in a bad way. I think it's mostly a bad way.
But addiction, but you think you could just loosen yourself, free yourself of the addiction just by your will. You could stop it for a couple
of
days.
Well, I think I am much easier for me to go without the news for a day in general. I could do that. I've done it before.
You have?
Yeah.
When was that?
Just when I've gone away somewhere, I'm doing something for the weekend.
If you were going to the Cape for a week, you'd say, I don't really need to know what's going on with Donald Trump. I don't need to know if the Mueller report has come out. I don't need to know if they're charging Michael Cohen with perjury for lying to the House Oversight Committee. You don't need to know any of that stuff.
Well, I think the Mueller report, that would be such a big deal that people would alert me that the Mueller report had arrived. But Cohen on perjury, or what has Donald Trump done over the weekend, or his latest tweets? For a couple of days, I could do it, yeah.
I'm proud of you. 877-301-8970. Could you do it, and would you want to do it? Tom in Chelmsford, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling. Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
Yeah, this summer I went on, I just got Trump overload, and I did a 2-month, I'm not listening to any news or reading any news, and I just took a complete break from it for July, August, and actually the first half of September.
Wow.
And were there not moments, Tom, when you were anxious that you were missing something that really matters, or you were fine with it?
There were some times, because also, you know, I'm always listening to NPR, and I'm always reading news feeds on my phone. Uh-huh. So I was kind of, I think as Marjorie mentioned earlier, you're just on overload because
you are.
Before Trump, we never seemed to have somebody that took over the media like this, and it's now it's just constant.
You know, Tom, it's funny you say that. Marjorie, I don't know if we've ever said this on the air. I think we have. I know we say it off the air. What did cable news used to do with all of their hours of prime time? Now, if it's 12 hours of prime time, it's what, 11 and a half hours of Trump? During Obama, what was it, an hour a day on Obama? What else did they cover?
They covered some real stories.
Animal stories?
They probably should be covering.
Probably,
I mean,
right.
One of the
Tom,
sad things
for your call.
Is that Trump makes a lot of money for all media, for us, for newspapers.
Because there are more eyeballs, you mean.
Because people are obsessed with Donald Trump. I mean, Paul just emailed this. He said he could give up Trump 100%. But could any media risk the loss of sponsors and give up Trump for a day? And I think Trump has driven a lot of business. Do they go out and cover the candidates, what the candidates are doing? I mean, CNN has had town halls.
But that's a pretty big deal.
Well, it is a pretty big deal. But you would think, since we're getting into the presidential election, that we don't have to devote the entire hour of a show to Donald Trump.
By the way, those
Maybe
town halls are not only not Trump-free. I've only watched part of a few. Yep. A huge percentage of the town halls with Democrats are about Donald Trump. So they're not giving up Trump.
Well, I'm saying that it might be nice to hear about some of the candidates' activities or proposals. You know, they could squeeze those in somewhere. But most of the time, the evening cable is all about Trump,
it
right?
Is. You're acting really grown up in this conversation. I'm serious. I hope you're right about yourself. Surely I couldn't do it. Johnny and Quincy, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hello. How you doing, guys?
Great.
I had to stop listening to it. I found myself very angry every single day and very, like, anxious and very stressed out. Mm-hmm. And then even my friends were telling me, all you talk about is Trump. We're sick of it. And I had to look at myself and I said, wait a minute. And I completely changed. And now I get my news later during the day. And I just get my news from, like, Comedy Central and things like that because it was too much. Like, he is always going to do something ridiculous. He's always going to do something stupid. So now I've just really have limited anything that I hear about him.
So how hard was that to do?
It was hard because, you know, like, we know that he's doing something and we want to comment. And I am a teacher, so, you know, when we are eating, we want to, you know, be... You know, like in the known. So now what I do, I just have my headphones on, and I am not a part of it.
I admire you as well. Thank you very much for the call. You know what she described that's an interesting perspective?
What?
Again, if you don't do this for a living, whatever it is that we do for a living, how about you limit your doses, meaning you say to yourself, I'm not going to give them up totally because I can't, but I'm going to do a summary of Trump's news of the day from 7 to 8 p.m. or 1 hour at the end of the day. Which is what she described,
though
Comedy Central is her source, but whatever the source
that's
is.
That's actually what I'm thinking of doing myself.
Are you serious?
Well, because I got into this horrible habit since he became the president. I used to, like, read a book at night before I went to sleep or read the book in bed, and now I've gone to my iPad, the latest. I mean, I'm clicking on the latest stories to make sure I'm up to the second on what's happened before I've gone to bed. So I'm trying to stop doing that.
Are
to
you
go
doing
back
this? I didn't
to the
know
book
this.
And not to watch... You know, if I'm cleaning the house or cooking or whatever, I don't really need to watch 3 hours of cable TV. I can watch 1 hour and more or less figure out what's going on with the president instead of having to waste all my time. You know, oh my God, what are they going to say about next?
By the way, it is true. For those who don't believe Marjorie is reading books again, she actually, I just saw she was carrying Fear, Trump in the White House by Bob Woodward. Is that not the latest? Is that not the latest?
No, I think.
What are you reading?
Some other guy, Sims, didn't he write something about?
Oh, the guy who worked for him, who was suing him.
Yeah.
Who's suing?
Yeah.
Non-disclosure agreement that he theoretically signed.
Yeah, and he really kind of trashed him in that book too, I guess. But Jackie just said that there's an app for Chrome that will replace any image of Donald Trump with pictures of kittens. It's called Make America Kittens Again. And she's considering installing it. And I just looked at it. And indeed, there is a story on there all about Chris Christie endorses Donald Trump and calls Marco Rubio desperate. And underneath that is an adorable picture of this little white kitten instead of Donald Trump.
Well, you know what I've done also? Actually, I wasn't even conscious of this till you said this. Mm-hmm. One of the ways, if you get a lot of your news, at least your angles, and then you go read the underlying story on Twitter, I told you I follow Baby Animals now, which is a Twitter site, which is embarrassing. But it gives you, in between the Trump stories, a little something to smile at. It's actually sort of fun. So I guess unknowingly, I was doing exactly what that person was doing. Where
but
do you want to go?
I do know people who say they just have to take a break because they just can't take it anymore. As the previous caller was saying, you get too angry and upset. You're thinking, what am I doing? Running around, worked into a frenzy.
But how do you, even though I understand for your mental health, that's really probably a mm-hmm. good thing, in light of the fact that virtually everything he does has immense or potentially immense impact on our lives and the people we care about. How do you rationalize? Is it the mental health thing? You just say it's more important that I tamp it down and be healthy?
Well, I guess. I mean, since you are not the president or the vice president or a member of Congress.
I am not.
You
no,
can
not.
Wait a day maybe or 2 days before you know all these things.
Let me ask you something.
But instead of that, I mean, I was glued to these Michael Cohen hearings like I was going to Disney World or something. We were all so excited.
Well, let me ask
remember
you,
when they announced the days of the
course,
hearings, we were saying,
couldn't
oh,
believe
my God,
it.
Can't
great.
Wait. And then when they were postponed, I was devastated.
But let me
That's
ask you this.
That's a little much, isn't it?
Do you
it?
Think it is necessary? One of the things I'm trying to wean myself mm-hmm. off of, is it necessary to watch the exact same discussion on CNN five times in
exactly.
a row? I generally feel by the
exactly.
third time I've gotten the point of, you know, is Michael Cohen, did he perjure himself in his testimony before the
yeah.
House Oversight Committee?
Or you've watched an hour in CNN, then you got to go see what Fox News is doing. And if it's a bad day for the president, inevitably, this is one of their stock things.
They do baby animals.
Well, no, they don't do baby animals.
I'm
they
joking.
Do. They do some conservative speaker was screamed off, UC Berkeley, you know,
oh,
the
God,
lefty college. They'll do some outrage about some lefty affront to someone that was conservative. It's amazing how they do that. They will just ignore stories completely. And then you go see what MSNBC is doing. So that's what I do a lot of times. I'll switch among the stations.
That's
you
know? Calming, I know.
No, really. It's not calming. It's really demented.
So the reason we're having this discussion is Alex Beam wrote his usual provocative column suggesting that what he was giving up for Lent was Donald Trump. We want to know if you could do it or would want to do it. Gretchen, you're in the car. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for calling.
Hey,
hi.
Hello to both
oh, hi,
of you.
Gretchen.
Nice to hear you.
Hi,
long
Gretchen.
Time. Great
how
to hear you.
You guys are doing great. You're wonderful.
Thanks.
I'll tell you, you know, I was just, I'm home now a week, but I was in the hospital with the flu for 2 weeks.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I had to be in an, you know, it wasn't bad, Marjorie. It was like, it was just, I had to be isolated. And you know me, I love to talk. So it was really tough. But anyway, I was in a room all by myself in an isolation room. And I went into the emergency room, so I didn't have my cell phone. I didn't have a television. And it was 2 weeks, and I am a new woman. I read books. I read four. And you know what I did? I didn't read anything contemporary. I read Little Women over again.
Oh, my gosh.
And I read Little Men, which I had never read before. And I got to recommend it. Little Men is a cool book.
So, Gretchen, even though you're happy about the 2 weeks after the fact, were the first few days
yeah.
not difficult?
Oh, it was unbelievable.
Okay.
I called my 80-year-old mother, and I said, just bring it to the door. You don't have to come in. You don't have, she's like, I am not going anywhere
That's
near
great.
The hospital. It's flu season. She said, I'll tell you what's going on.
That's great. Hey, Gretchen,
oh, that was great.
Once you got going,
yep.
once you get going, it feels good. And I'm really trying now that I'm home not to be so crazy. Except the Michael Cohen thing just got me in again.
I know. I know.
Gretchen, it's great to hear from you. Thank you.
Listen to this from Joe. She says, I never watch or listen to Trump. I turn the sound down or change the channel. I refuse to give him any further space in my head. I was on the verge of a nervous breakdown. And then on the other hand, Amina says, I get the points, but how do you give up almost the worst thing to have happened in our lives ever? And yes, I do feel that way about this present. I try to enjoy the ride, but then I remember, my God, this is really happening. So that's the point, too, I suppose.
You know, by the way, I told you, I've told the story a couple of times. I went to Costa Rica. I was off the grid for a week. That was pre-Trump, but still feeling that you can't let the news go away. And exactly as Gretchen said, maybe it'd be different under Trump, but after a day or two, the peacefulness of it, the calm of it is really seductive. It's really great. And, you know, he's still going to be there, and you catch up on the news in your email when you catch up on the news in the email.
Listen to this. This is from Cindy.
What's that?
Ski, hike, walk in the woods,
I
visit a museum, and read about other controversial and corrupt administrations like Andrew Johnson's or like other terrible times in our country, and listen to audiobooks like Hamilton and Grant to get a true picture of the vitriol and name-calling in previous administrations. It is true that there was a lot of vitriol and name-calling in the Founding Fathers' days, too, remember?
So you feel better?
Yeah. No, I don't feel better. I'm a nervous wreck, as we know. John in the car. Hi, John.
Hey, John.
Hey, how are you?
Great.
Good.
Well, here's a topic that you're bringing up. I like listen to you guys, listen to you every day.
Thanks.
I pretty much don't agree with anything you say. But
perfect.
Here's the problem. It's not really us out here that are listening to you that's the problem. It is you, the talking heads, and you, the media, that are obsessed that every single story that you listen to on NPR, without a doubt, 90% of the stories are negative, and they're all casting doubt on the Trump administration, which basically causes fear and anxiety. It's not us. It's you guys.
Well, actually, plead guilty to half that. I don't know what the percentage is. A huge percentage of what we talk about is Donald Trump. I think when you say it's 90, whatever percentage it is that's negative, it's probably a majority for sure. I think it's on the merits. Are you suggesting that we spend more time highlighting the good things out of proportion to the negative things so that there's what? So there's more balance? They are what they are, right? I mean, you can't say it's great that he is saying that they're good people, on fine people on both sides when they're chanting the Jews will not replace us. I mean, what are we going to say?
Okay, well, you know, that's inflammatory, but there's an umpire philosophy about how you see things, how the umpire calls the balls and the strikes when they come in.
Yeah.
And that whole thing, you can refresh us, Jim, because I'm sure you're familiar with that. But it's always how you guys see it, not how they are or how other people perceive it. It's how you see it. And that's the problem.
John, can I tell you something? By the way, you are totally misunderstanding the function of the show. If we wanted it to be how we see it, we wouldn't take phone calls. What we do is we talk all day long. Excuse me, we talk. But the beauty.
I've called you in the past, and you've one cut me off. And you've got very inflamed, especially you, Jim, get very inflamed when I call, because I call you out on the merit.
John, you know why? You know why I hung up? No, John. You know why I hung up on you last week? And thanks for your call, John, because I'm hanging up on you again, is because you told a story about Ted Kennedy and the KGB, and we asked you to send us a copy, and we discuss it after we read it, because we weren't familiar with it. You rudely said, look it up yourself, at which point I said, thanks for the call. And we did look it up ourselves, and you made up the story. So that's why.
No, the story was on Fox News.
Fox News, my apologies.
And it wasn't true.
Well, right, it was a made-up story. Right. I didn't mean that he personally made it up. My apologies. So, again, but let me be clear, for people who feel that they don't get the balance that John would like, as long as you're truthful with us, that's why we take calls every single day. Every single day we take calls because we want to give people who agree and who disagree an opportunity to be heard.
Okay, we are moving on.
I think we are.
Yes, because we're going to talk about television coming up. TV's Bob Thompson is going to be here with us to go over the latest TV headlines. Bob Thompson next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. For 35 years, Alex Trebek has been a constant presence, embedding himself in our homes and in popular culture by asking us some of the toughest questions night after night after night. Now with news that he has stage 4 pancreatic cancer, we have some tough questions of our own. Can he beat it? And if not, what will become of Jeopardy? Joining us for his take on this and other TV developments is Bob Thompson. Bob's professor and founding director of the Bleier Center for TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse. Hello, Bob.
Hello, both of you.
Hello, Bob Thompson. Great to talk to you as always. So I believe this week we are starting with your worst. What is it?
Well, that news is really bad news. 35 years, there's some things we just don't think are ever going to change. And, of course, they do have to change. Bob Barker left The Price is Right. Even things that seem to go on forever don't. But I think this was news that nobody had any response but a sad one to. But it does allow us to, I think, ask some really interesting questions. First of all, I think one of the reasons was a bunch of reasons why Jeopardy is so satisfying. Number one is so many people with these good liberal arts educations leave college, don't have the opportunity to use that knowledge when they become accountants and doctors and lawyers, whatever they become. And Jeopardy is the place where you can everything you had on all those syllabi, you can actually apply. But the second thing is one that Ken Jennings, who, of course, was on the show for the longest run in the history of the planet, and he just wrote a piece for the New York Times, an opinion piece that played a couple of days ago. And he called him our generation's Cronkite, the last Cronkite. And that's worth examining. I think it's hyperbolic. I don't think it's completely true, but he makes some points. Number one, one of the satisfying things about Jeopardy is that Alex had a bunch of questions, answers actually, but questions for all intents and purposes, And he had the facts, and you either got them or you didn't get them. You got them right or you got them wrong. You got the points if you got them right. There was no panel discussing whether the answer was right or wrong. It was just either right or wrong. And I think these days, when we are so challenged by this issue of facts and whether they even exist or not, made Jeopardy so kind of calming and reassuring that points were given, and at the end somebody won, and nobody had to go to a shouting panel to give it.
You know,
the other thing that's, I guess, kind of like Cronkite is that this was completely anybody could watch this. College kids liked it. Grandpa liked it. Kids could watch it. It's been on forever. The big difference, though, Cronkite was going to Vietnam and doing editorials about it. Cronkite was reporting on the death of JFK. Cronkite was explaining as we got to the moon. There is a difference between a quiz show and somebody who is reporting the news, a quiz show host and a journalist. And for all the respect I have for Alex Trebek, and I have much respect for him, that difference is a pretty big one.
Well, I think the comparison really is a little. I mean, remember Alex Trebek moderating that Pennsylvania debate last year? I don't think Walter Cronkite would have done it that way. By the way, you mentioned Ken Jennings, who I think won 74 in a row or whatever it was.
Not a lot.
Here's
like
an exchange that between Trebek and this legendary contestant, Ken Jennings.
This term for a long-handled gardening tool can also mean an immoral pleasure seeker. Ken.
What's a hoe?
No. Whoa. 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 They teach you that in school in Utah, huh? Al,
what's a rake?
A rake is right.
That's pretty great, actually.
Yeah. Yeah. We also have a great quote from one of our, Jim and mine, favorite nighttime commentators on CNN, Jeffrey Toobin, who said about Trebek, I love this, he just seems sort of immortal. I don't see him as having aged much. I always found that when you arrive in a hotel room where you have no real sense of where you are, turning on Jeopardy is always kind of grounding, serenely the same at all times. And I thought that was so true. I mean, as other people have said, this reminds you of your mother or your grandmother or a tradition you had after dinner watching Jeopardy with your family. And there was that sameness that Toobin refers to that I think appeals to people, you know?
You're right. I think that was a really good observation. And, you know, that doesn't just happen. Something doesn't stay on for 35 years for no reason. We use a lot of our time on Mondays talking about all these fancy shows and everything. But Jeopardy has consistently been a success and something people like for 35 years.
Yeah.
And actually for 10 years before that with a different host. It's won 33 Emmys. 5, I think, to Trebek. It won a Peabody Award. Yes, Jeopardy won a Peabody Award. So there's a space for, Breaking Bad and True Detective, but there's also obviously a space for Jeopardy, and it's on 5 days a week, and it doesn't go on too many vacations, and people continue to watch it.
We're talking to Bob Thompson, our TV guy. What's the best of the week there, Bob?
Oh, just played last night. What was it? What's the full title? Aretha! Exclamation point.
Oh, yeah.
A Grammy celebration for the Queen of Soul on CBS, 2 hours. And this was so satisfying because as we're having all of these conversations of which great musicians we can no longer play their music anymore, we can play Aretha's, and they sure did last night. Clips of her former performances. It opened with something from the Clinton inauguration that was just beautiful. Performances by Patti LaBelle, Alicia Keys, Jennifer Hudson, on and on and on and on and on. It was one of those performance specials that I think will go down with. Remember Motown 25 back
yes.
in 1985, which I still every now and again pop in the VHS and watch again. This had some really, really extraordinary performances and reminds us how deep the list of Aretha's songs was.
Let's give people a sense of this. This is a clip of Jennifer Hudson singing Respect from CBS Aretha Franklin, a Grammy tribute special. Here it is.
You know, there may be only one Aretha, but Jennifer Hudson is
great.
She's fantastic.
It's so, I mean, all these singers they had lined up were fantastic. So let's go
that
to the...
That opened the show, and it ended with Fantasia and three others, but Fantasia was really ripping it, doing Natural Woman and lots of other great stuff in between. A couple people are complaining that they got a French-Canadian, Celine Dion, also a wonderful performer, and she did a wonderful performance, but she did A Change Is Gonna Come, and in the back on the screen were all these segregation era photographs of, you know, whites only signs and Dr. King and all that kind of stuff. And some people thought that that may have been not the best match for song and performer. But other than that, I'm not hearing any complaints about that.
By the way, the New York Times story in advance of this said she was offered five songs, five Franklin songs, meaning Celine Dion. And that's the song she chose. So that, I thought that was pretty interesting, actually.
So, Bob, let's go.
I don't have a real problem with that.
Let's go from the sublime on CBS to the rather horrifying on CBS. Gail King's interview with the singer R. Kelly, who, of course, has been accused of felonies involving his sexual relationships, or if I even call them relationships, with underage women.
Let's play, let's start by playing a clip from this interview. Not the one with Kenan Thompson on Saturday Night Live playing R. Kelly, which was brilliant, but Kelly himself directly addressing her, the media and his accusers.
Robert, stop it. Y'all quit playing. Quit playing. Robert. I didn't do this stuff. This is not me. Y'all, I'm fighting for my life. Y'all killing me with this. I gave y'all 30 years of my career.
Robert.
30 years of my career. Y'all trying to kill me. You killing me, man. This is not about music. I'm trying to have a relationship with my kids, and I can't do it. Y'all just don't want to believe the truth. You don't want to believe it.
You know, if there was an Emmy for calm...
Yeah.
I think Gail King would win that. Her behavior through that rant was perfect,
hands
I thought.
Folded.
Just perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the way she, whenever I used to have a temper tantrum, my mother used to say, Robert, exactly like that. She's become kind of the great American hero through this. She's, everybody's celebrating that picture of him towering above her and her sitting there cool as a cucumber has become one of the iconic photos of the year and probably of the decade. And, of course, everybody has seen the clips. They've been playing like crazy. I would like to just mention one other thing. Of course, that interview was disturbing. Of course, what it was about was incredibly disturbing. He was disturbing. But the way in which CBS kind of delightfully, they were so happy to have this interview. And they were so, the way it went, it was so dramatic. And they teased it like crazy. They played it on Wednesday. They played it again on Thursday. They had a special hour-long on Friday. And I remember right after the Wednesday interview, Gail is talking with her colleagues, and she's saying what's up for tomorrow morning, Thursday morning. And after she says it, she goes, that's a pretty good tease, isn't it? And I thought, that's a little weird. You're talking about this very, very creepy stuff, and you're bragging about your tease. Then on Thursday, the four of them are talking about the Friday special, and one of them, not Gail, but she's at the table, says, so, lots of stuff on CBS this weekend. Get your snacks ready.
Oh.
The idea that we're going to watch an R. Kelly interview with snacks was further creepy. And then Gail King goes on Colbert, of course, and she starts telling about how she was in the green room waiting to come out on Colbert, and Elton John called her to compliment her on the interview with R. Kelly. Now, none of this stuff is categorically bad in and of itself, but given the nature of this interview and what this story was trying to expose, that kind of promotional celebration, I have to say, was a little creepy.
I couldn't agree more. You know, you use the word iconic. Let me play a clip for you. Speaking of icons, here is an iconic Simpson episode clip, guest starring Michael Jackson. Homer is forced to go to an insane asylum. I think it's third season or something, and meets his fellow inmate,
third season,
who claims he is Michael Jackson despite being an overweight, white, bald man.
I can't believe you never heard of me. I'm a very popular entertainer.
Oh, of course I've heard of you. I mean, you'd have to be living under a rock not to know. What'd you say your name was?
Michael Jackson.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Well, have you heard of MTV?
Nope.
Motown?
No.
Beat It?
You Beat It.
Thriller?
What was that last one?
Thriller.
Nope.
Well, how about this?
Wow. How do you do that thing with your feet?
The moonwalk?
No, that thing with your feet.
Here, look. Just raise your heel a bit and put a little pressure on the ball of your foot.
Huh?
You seem like a nice guy. Why'd they put you in here?
Because I wore a pink shirt.
I understand. People thought I was crazy for the way I dressed.
What'd you wear?
One white glove covered with rhinestones.
So people may not hear that after this, Bob Thompson.
No, James Brooks, who, of course, is the executive producer, the boss of the show, wants to take this, and he said it'll take time, but he wants to remove it from all TV platforms, syndication, on-demand service, and future reissues of DVDs and Blu-rays. So that's a pretty extensive, I mean, you know, TV Land took Cosby off of their lineup, but I don't think anybody has taken Cosby off of DVD sales. So this is something that he seems to really want to make go away. He's quoted as saying in the Wall Street Journal, I'm against book burning of any kind, but this is our book and we're allowed to take out a chapter, which I guess is true. But that seems a more radical kind of response to one of the these problems than we've seen in a long time. Whether that all happens, by the way, is yet to be seen.
You know, we were talking to a colleague of ours, Sue O'Connell, who prior to publishing a couple of newspapers in town and doing a television show was a DJ, worked in the music side of radio. And we were talking to her the other day about what our radio people, executives, going to do about Jackson's songs. And she said there's going to be a split, not on principle, but because he's so huge. What's your sense of how far people in TV and related industries go with Jackson, The Wiz and all this other stuff, in light of the fact that he was as hugely popular as he was?
Well, we've talked about this a lot in too many contexts, unfortunately. But I think ultimately you cannot make the work of these people go away. It's an important part of the culture. It's an important part of history. If you try to erase everything Michael Jackson has done, you're not going to be able to understand anything that happens after it. On the other hand, I think for a period of time after these stories have broken, just out of sensitivity, not to be all of us. I mean, to have watched Leaving Neverland and then to get in an elevator or go into your dentist office and start hearing Beat It or Bad or something like that, that does seem a really dissonant problem. I think it's kind of like, you know, after 9/11, radio stations took out a whole list of songs that they thought would be insensitive. Great Balls of Fire was one of them. And I think that was a perfectly fine decision. I don't think you take them out forever, for a period of time to express some kind of solidarity that there is a problem here. In the end, though, I think to kind of erase this stuff and make it go away is just not something one can rationally do.
We're talking with Bob Thompson, our TV man. So apparently there's quite a controversy about whether Netflix films should be included in awards like in Cannes, or I guess Steven Spielberg has complained about this too. What's going on?
Yes, well, and this is going to continue as the definition. We used to know what a movie was and what a TV show was. One we watched on a television set, and one we had to go out and watch in a movie house, in a theater. And then that began to shift and blend as television started showing movies on TV. And then the VHS tape came out and all the rest of it. And now with streaming, we've got this whole new way in which it's neither television nor movie, but they're making things that look like movies. So anyway, that's a long preface to Spielberg thinks that streaming service stuff, including Netflix, should not be eligible for Oscars. He thinks they should be eligible for Emmys. And Cannes had 2017 included Netflix movies in it. 2018, they made a new rule that all their candidates had to have had theatrical release in France. So Netflix pulled theirs, and now they're battling it out. And I doubt we're going to see Netflix in 2019 at Cannes either.
You know, you clicked out in my headphones for a second. This is all about making sure people continue to go to the theaters.
Movies.
Is that what it's? Yeah. That's what it's about, right?
Well, I think yes. And Spielberg, I think it's in principle. He believes in the idea of the big screen and people in a social setting in a theater watching movies. With Cannes, I think it's also about France, which has got a theater industry which doesn't want to be completely taken down by people streaming. We should all remember, though, that and I agree with I'm very much in sympathy with what Spielberg is talking about. Watching a movie in a theater is a totally different experience and one that I would hate to lose. But I also have to say, even when I was in college, and we're talking about the late 1970s, early 1980s, most of what I knew about the American cinema, I was watching on a little TV set. The Godfather, I saw for the first time on TV.
Oh,
the Graduate,
goodness.
I saw for the first time on TV. I got a cinema education staying up late at night watching those late night movies. So many more people can get access, and that's what Netflix's response to Spielberg was, though they didn't name him by name, who just don't have the opportunity, right, the wherewithal, or even don't live in a city that happened to release these films. And I agree with that Netflix argument as well.
By the way, even if you do have access to the theater, sitting on the couch in a robe with a drink is a pretty good way to watch a movie, I should say.
So what to watch this week, Bob?
CNN is trotting out yet another one of these presidential miniseries. While the Bush years is still going, this Sunday they're going to start a four-part Tricky Dick. And
Tricky
I've seen
Dick.
Little bits of it, and it looks very interesting.
That was my reaction. The
Tricky
fact
Dick.
That they
Do they
titled
have to name
it Tricky,
Tricky
Dick?
Dick? I don't know. Okay.
Well, it probably fits.
We have a little sound from this. This is a preview of CNN's Tricky Dick, where Nixon's press secretary Ron Ziegler tells the press President Nixon will be addressing the nation during the height of the Watergate scandal.
I'm aware of the intense interest concerning developments over the last few days. This has, of course, not been a difficult time. Tonight at 9:00 Eastern Daylight Time, the President of the United States will address the nation on radio and television from his Oval Office.
You know, I don't know if I've ever told you this, Marjorie. I'm sure I haven't told you this, Bob. When I lived in New York City, I one day saw Nixon and Pat Nixon walking in Central Park, hand in hand.
Oh, no, I've never heard that.
And, you know, ordinarily when you see whether they're famous politicians or big stars, there's like a gaggle of real people who can't, you know, they don't know how close or how far away to be, but there are a lot of people, other than Secret Service people, who you could basically see peppered around them. There was virtually nobody who was attempting to say hello, nobody who was approaching. It was really a study in isolation, I should say. It was sort of interesting.
Well, what year was this?
I don't know. I don't know what year. They were pretty old, but I don't know what year it was, Bob.
It was after he left the presidency.
Oh, yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Well, this only gets four parts, as opposed to the Bush family gets six parts.
Well, R. Kelly got six, too. Yeah. So, I mean, you'd think.
Yeah, right. That's right.
Least... It could be 10 more before this is over.
Hey,
Bob,
thanks.
You.
Talk to you next week.
I look forward to it. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob Thompson. Bob Thompson joins us every week. He's the founding director of the Blair Center for TV and Popular Culture and a trustee professor of TV and Popular Culture at the Newhouse School of Public Communications at Syracuse University. We are done. Thank you very much for listening to Boston Public Radio. You can catch us 24/7 by way of our podcast, Boston Public Radio, on iTunes. Tomorrow we're going to be at the library. You can hear us in person, see us in person, or hear us on WGBH.
You can actually show up at the library on like Friday?
I'm going to show up tomorrow.
That's great.
Jim.
That's good.
I'm going
to
show
hear.
Up tomorrow. Thank yeah. You. Trini Kuznarek is going to be there, our legal analyst, Michael Zeldin, food writer, Corby Kummer. I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tureski, Arjun Singh, and our engineer, John LaClaw. Parker, what's on TV? Jim?
Well, former federal judge Nancy Gertner is going to join me. She had a piece in the Washington Post the last couple of days talking about a current federal judge and why he only sentenced Paul Manafort to 47 months.
Oh,
she's
gosh.
Fairly critical.
Great.
And she'll also predict what another federal judge is going to do to Manafort on Wednesday. And then a new culture writer for the Boston Globe, Janae Osterholt, is going to join me. And we're going to talk about these kidnappings of these women coming
fantastic.
Out of bars. She is really a
talented, very
talented woman. I haven't met her before.
A really different sort of writer.
She really is.
I'll be looking forward to that.
So that's all tonight. Greater all right. Boston at 7 o'clock. What do you mean, all right?
All right, that's good.
You're rushing me out of
I'm
here.
Rushing me.
you got to go?
I'm in a hurry. Heavy date, Jim, right after
okay.
the show.
Okay, see you later. I'll
I'm
see you
Marjorie
tomorrow.
Egan.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow or visit us at the library. And have a great afternoon.